You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
This week on Talk Nation Radio, a new book called King of Spies, The Dark Reign of America's Spy Master in Korea by Blaine Hardin. Blaine Hardin served as the Washington Post's bureau chief in East Asia, Eastern Europe, and Africa. He also worked as a national correspondent for the New York Times and has contributed to The Economist, PBS Frontline, Time, and Foreign Policy. He is the author of The Great Leader and the Fighter Pilot, Escape from Camp 14, an international bestseller that has been published in 28 languages, A River Lost, and Africa, Dispatches from a Fragile Continent, which won a Penn American Center citation for a first book of nonfiction. Blaine Hardin, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Good to be with you.
Great to have you on. That's quite a lineup of books, and this newest one I highly recommend to everyone listening, The King of Spies. Who was the King of Spies?
Well, his name was Donald Nichols, and he was an unlikely spy in that he had a seventh-grade dropout. He came from a desperately poor and fouled-up family, and he joined the Army when he was 17. And he served in World War II, but he really didn't become an intelligence agent until the Korean War. In fact, he started training for that war. He went to Korea 4 years before it started. So he learned to speak the language passably. He learned the context in the country. And he befriended the man who would become the most powerful man in South Korea, Syngman Rhee. And that relationship, which was sort of a father-son relationship of a 70-year-old autocrat with a 23-year-old intelligence agent, was the source of Nichols' power, and also it pushed him into the darkness that characterized much of his career.
Well, can you elaborate on darkness?
Well, Syngman Rhee was America's puppet in the South, in a divided Korea. And Syngman Rhee, besides fighting against the North Koreans in the Korean War, fought a civil war against his own people, who wanted land reform and who wanted a more socialist kind of government than he was willing to support. He was backed by property owners, primarily people who were relatively well off in Korea and who had collaborated with the colonial Japanese before World War II. In any case, the two sides went to war in a very, very brutal civil war that preceded the Korean War. And in that war, Donald Nichols got involved. He trained the police. He attended torture sessions. He attended mass killings. And he did not report up the chain of command about the atrocities that he was a witness to. I found a picture of Donald Nichols standing on the roof of the South Korean Army headquarters in Seoul in the late 1940s. And next to him was a human head in a bucket. And this was the kind of world that Donald Nichols lived in for about 11 years in Korea. He had an extraordinarily long tenure, 11 years in any place for an intelligence agent, particularly one who calls himself the son of the head of state. It's something just outside of the parameters of intelligence operations, and it's probably accurate to say that Donald Nichols was unique.
Unique indeed. It's a phenomenal story, but the atrocities that he was part of, the license he was given to murder and destroy, was knowingly given, right? I mean, it was understood by his superiors in the U.S. military and the U.S. government that this is what he was doing.
Well, I'm not so sure that his superiors knew exactly what he was doing in terms of hanging out on the roof with severed heads. But I do know that for a couple reasons, Donald Nichols was given an incredibly long leash to do what he saw fit. And part of it was that there was a huge vacuum of intelligence operatives in Korea before the start of the Korean War in 1950, those 4 years after Nichols arrived in 1946 until the war started. There was a vacuum that sort of gave the field to whoever wanted it, and whoever wanted it the best, the most, and could do the best job, and that was Nichols. So he filled a vacuum. And then when the war started, suddenly this was, you know, the number one issue for the United States government. How do we fight back against this North Korean invasion? How do we preserve South Korea? And they were very short on answers. And one of the few people who really knew what he was doing on the ground and who immediately began providing bombing targets within 4 days of the invasion, he was sending detailed bombing targets to the U.S. Air Force in Tokyo. So Nichols was really in the catbird seat. And because he had information, he had a plan, he was then given power. When the war started, he was a master sergeant. And within about 4 months, he was a major. So that kind of promotion is just astonishing. In fact, he was promoted so fast that the chief general in charge of the Air Force, George Stratemeyer, he had to write to the Joint Chiefs to sort of explain why they were promoting this guy so fast. And his reason was that he's the best we have. We have to give him authority in the field.
And Sigmund Rhee, who Nichols had this tight relationship with, tell people a little bit about where he came from, specifically the Washington, D.C. area.
Right. Sigmund Rhee was an extremely interesting and difficult man. He was born in Korea. He was jailed for a time when he was extremely young, in his teens. And he did not cooperate with the colonial Japanese authorities. And then he left. He won the attention of some American missionaries who sponsored his travel to the United States when he was quite a young man in his 20s. And when he got to the United States, he acquired the most glittering educational credentials of any Korean individual on earth. He got a BA from George Washington University, a MA in history from Harvard, and then a PhD in international history from Princeton, this trifecta of credentials that allowed him to sort of represent himself as the presence in Washington of the Korean people. And so he was in Washington, in and around Washington, on the East Coast, for most of his life. And in 1946, when the Americans cut the Korean Peninsula in half, they needed somebody who they thought would be a malleable English-speaking puppet to be the titular head of South Korea, because they knew that in the North, the Soviet Union had found their own puppet, Kim Il-sung, who's the grandfather of Kim Jong-un, the man who is now threatening the United States with nuclear-tipped ballistic missiles. But Sigmund Rhee was, when he arrived in South Korea in 1946, he quickly turned into a very difficult-to-manage puppet. No puppet at all, in fact. But as he was trying to position himself to use the power of the American government to increase his power, he met Donald Nichols. Sigmund Rhee was 71 at the time. Nichols was 23. Nichols was as raw a intelligence officer as you could imagine, but they found favor in each other's eyes. And what happened was that Sigmund Rhee used Nichols as a kind of back channel to deliver the kind of information that he wanted delivered to the highest levels of the intelligence community of the United States. And Nichols used his contact with Sigmund Rhee to enhance his power. He made it clear to his colonels and generals that he was the only American who had this 24-hour access to Sigmund Rhee. And then he also went around to other officials in the South Korean government and said, "Your president is my friend." And he would used that position to give himself power and information. So they both the relationship was long and lucrative for both of them. It lasted for 11 years until Nichols was removed from the Korean Peninsula.
Yeah, we're speaking with Blaine Harden, the author of King of Spies, The Dark Reign of America's Spy Master in Korea. Now, Syngman Rhee wanted to unify the peninsula under his own rule and wanted a war and was engaging in raids across the border and seeking to start a war, was he not?
He was. And he was in the similarities between Syngman Rhee and Kim Il-sung. At that point in history, from 1946 until 1950, they're very much alike. They were both belligerent. They both wanted to unify the Korean Peninsula using arms from their respective mothership, Soviet Union under Stalin for Kim Il-sung, and the United States military under Harry Truman. But as those years ground on from 46 to 1950, the two puppet leaders who became authoritarian dictators during that time, they had much different results in terms of getting military backing. Stalin slowly started to give Kim Il-sung the means to go to war. Modern aircraft, modern artillery, and all the trimmings for a military invasion. And at the same time, Truman started to take those things away from Syngman Rhee. By the time the invasion of from North Korea into the South occurred in the summer of 1950, there were only about 500 American military people there. There was no modern aircraft. Very little artillery. In a sense, Truman had turned South Korea into a sitting duck.
But the reason I ask is that in the book you recount how this King of Spies, Don Nichols, was able to accurately predict that there was going to be a war, whereas the rest of the U.S. military was sort of willfully oblivious. And I wonder if part of his ability to predict that there was going to be a war came out of the fact that he was buddies with one of the two parties trying to start the war.
Well, there is some truth to that. But Nichols, by 1950, had established his own independent sources of information. He had a large Korean staff that was reporting to him, and he had connections across the north of the 38th parallel. So I have seen hundreds of intelligence reports that he wrote that are based on eyewitness reports from agents that were reporting to him and his organization that talked about where the Russians were building new air bases and bringing in new aircraft, and the same for artillery and APCs and tanks. So Nichols was well-sourced, and he provided this very specific information about when the invasion was coming to Douglas MacArthur and his chief of intelligence. And one of the peculiarities about the power structure in the Far East at that time was MacArthur was based in Tokyo. He was rehabilitating Japan for integration into the world economy. And he did a great job, but he was very focused on what he was doing, and he didn't want to waste resources, money, intelligence, time, worrying about the Korean Peninsula. And his chief of intelligence, a man named Charles Willoughby, was an expert in giving MacArthur exactly what MacArthur wanted. MacArthur did not want to learn what he didn't already know. And so Willoughby suppressed and ignored and discredited intelligence reports coming from Korea saying that an invasion was imminent. In fact, some of Nichols' reports were so annoying to Willoughby that he tried to fire Nichols and tried to force him off the Korean Peninsula. He failed. But in any case, the Americans broadly were caught with their pants down when the invasion occurred.
The reports that you describe in the book by Nichols as being so brilliant and detailed and informative and valuable to the U.S. military seem odd in that his formal education was up through what part of seventh grade, and he later in his life hires a school teacher to help him with grammar when he's writing his autobiography. I mean, were they really brilliant? I haven't read them, and you have, or were
they? Well, I have, and they were. They were really good. In fact, the reason I was impressed by one of them in particular is on a previous book, I was writing about a North Korean fighter pilot who defected in 1953 in a celebrated defection that brought the Americans the first access to a battle-ready MiG.
Right.
This was a big deal, actually one of the major defections of the Cold War. And Nichols was the lead interrogator when the pilot landed in South Korea with this MiG. And within about 6 days, Nichols wrote about a 28-30-page report on what he'd learned and what the world had learned about what had gone on in the Korean War secretly that the pilot had told him. And it was well done, and it was done under deadline pressure, and it was read by every important intelligence official in the United States government. And Nichols was really congratulated for that document, that report, not only by me 60 years later when I read it, I thought, boy, this is good work, but by all of the military intelligence officials who read it. And it was one of the major reasons why he was allowed to stay on for 4 more years after the war. It just was a great piece of intelligence work. Maybe he had a secretary at that point who could clean up his spelling and grammar, I don't know. But his ability to cogitate and to understand the broader ramifications of what this defection meant were extraordinary. Nichols, not everybody who drops out of school is stupid. He was a really bright guy.
Yeah, and self-educated, it seems like. There wasn't a particular tutor or maestro for him along the way.
Well, I didn't find one. I think that he had this sort of street cunning, and, you know, he did also write thousands of reports during the war. He learned his craft by doing it under incredible deadline pressure for 3 solid years, rarely taking a day off.
Now, you've sort of unearthed this unknown but central and important story from the Korean War for a U.S. audience, but as you recount, he was known in North Korea, and he was put on trial publicly in absentia for war crimes in North Korea. Can you describe what happened there?
Well, what happened after the war was over, Kim Il-sung had a very bad war. His army was destroyed by the United Nations force led by the Americans. His cities were destroyed by U.S. Air Force carpet bombing. And he lived a good part of the war in a bunker. And when the Chinese intervened in the fall of 1950 to save North Korea from going out of existence, the Chinese general in charge of the Chinese troops, he basically told Nichols to shut up, and told Kim Il-sung to go stand in a corner. He said, "You're a child, you're a poor leader, and I don't want you involved in the war that you started." So all of that was what actually happened during the war. But when the war was over, Kim Il-sung had to rehabilitate his image. He had to present a propaganda story to his own people saying that he was the brilliant general who kept the sneaky Americans and South Koreans from destroying North Korea. So they had a show trial. It was an elaborate fiction to try to rehabilitate Kim Il-sung's image. And in that show trial, Nichols was an important character. They said that Nichols had paid large amounts of cash to 11 North Korean officials to get them to try to overthrow Kim Il-sung and to kill him. Some of it was true, some of it wasn't. But in any case, Nichols' name was prominent in this trial, and that trial was covered by the Western press. But no one picked up on who Nichols was, and no one really believed the allegations. But as I read the allegations in the Rodong Sinmun, the party newspaper at the time that was published in Pyongyang, they were not too far from the truth. Nichols had paid off people to try to overthrow that government. And the North Koreans were very much aware of who Nichols were, and they sent at least one assassin to try to kill him.
And the Western press, or at least the U.S. press, as I recall in your book, didn't mention Nichols' name at all.
I could find nothing in the U.S. press or in any English-language news agency that mentioned Nichols by name. Yeah. He was in the North Korean press and on the radio where they talked about him, and that's where he was called the King of Spies.
Yeah. And you don't think that the obedience to the U.S. government of the U.S. press may have played a role there?
I don't know. I just don't know why he managed to lie so low. The reason I think he was lost to history, and this is the sort of the dark concluding chapters of the book, is Nichols was discredited and became a non-person because of the action of the U.S. Air Force, the branch of the military for which he worked. And what happened was in 1957, after Nichols had been in the country for 11 consecutive years and still very close to Syngman Rhee, and at the time Syngman Rhee was continuing to eliminate his political enemies by having them jailed or killed, Nichols was still close to Syngman Rhee at this point. At some point, the U.S. Air Force decided that they'd had enough of Donald Nichols in the country. In the summer of 1957, he was taken away from his own base. He had his own secret base near Seoul. He was taken away in a straitjacket. And according to his military service record and the psychiatric treatment notes that I've obtained, he was taken first to a military hospital in Japan, where he was put in the psych ward, and where he kept asking, "Why am I here?" And then he started to get really, really angry, pounding the walls, breaking windows, running outside in his pajamas. They,
as a sane person might
drug do. Him with, huh?
As a sane person might do in such a situation.
As a sane person might do. He was quickly diagnosed when he got to Tokyo, according to the medical records, as severely schizophrenic. A diagnosis that has no relation to his behavior when he was a spy. There was nothing in his military service record prior to that hospitalization to indicate that he was schizophrenic or in any way mentally ill. In any case, he only stayed for 2 weeks in Japan. Then he was put on a plane and then flown to Eglin Air Force Base, a very large Air Force Base in the Florida Panhandle. And he was taken there to the military hospital, put in the psych ward. And within a few days, they started to give him heavy treatments with electroshock every day for about a month, and then every other day for a couple more months. He said at the time that the U.S. Air Force was trying to destroy his memory. In any case, he was then forced out of the Air Force. And the electroshock had discredited him and also had confused him considerably. And he was done as a spy. I talked to a U.S. Air Force command historian for the Special Forces about Nichols, actually when I was beginning this book. And he said that everyone recognizes that Nichols was in many ways a founding father of special operations for the Air Force and for the military. He was a creative and innovative, hardworking guy during those 11 years in Korea. But they also knew that he had, this really big dark river flowing through the middle of his career. So what this guy said, he says, Nichols was the kind of guy you want fighting for you in time of war, but in time of peace, you lock him up. They locked him up only for a few months in a psychiatric facility, but then he was fundamentally destroyed as a spy and as a person, And he wandered in America for the next 30 years. And he described those years, those decades of his life, as being a member of the living dead, a kind of ex-spy zombie wandering in South Florida.
It is a bizarre and horrible story. We have just a few minutes left. Blaine Harden, I want to ask you, as someone who has studied the war in the 1950s in detail, what does the U.S. public need to know now that it doesn't understand about the way North Koreans might perceive things and approach the world?
I think what's really important to understand is, as the war was prosecuted after North Korea invaded the South, in a really brutal and punishing invasion, the Americans were for a couple months confused and overwhelmed. But, you know, the American war machine quickly recovered, and the most dominant part of it throughout the war was the bombing. These big B-29s, we had lots of B-29s left over from World War II. We had lots of trained pilots. We had, you know, warehouse after warehouse full of conventional bombs and napalm. And so the American Air Force went to work systematically bombing all of North Korea and blew up and burned down virtually all the cities in the country. Some estimates of the civilian death toll are as high as 20%, and those are estimates by U.S. Air Force generals. So it was a barbaric and cruel and sustained operation, and all the people of North Korea who are now alive have grandparents, or had grandparents or great uncles who were either killed or maimed or suffered terribly because of this. What the Kim family regime has done, rather brilliantly, is to take this fact-based narrative and keep it alive, keep it terrifyingly alive in the daily existence of all North Koreans. So they believe that Americans are inevitably going to come back with bombs and fire and death. And this fear and this anger, which is reinforced by propaganda and by isolation inside North Korea,
and by the U.S. president threatening to destroy the whole country. Right. The Korean regime hasn't brilliantly invented a U.S. president threatening to totally destroy their country, or a senator from Arizona threatening to exterminate them, right? That the U.S. is chipping in.
That's true. And what that does is it gives, it gives more fact-based energy to this narrative, and it makes it possible for this is the longest lived totalitarian regime in world history, more than twice as long as Stalin or Mao or anybody else. And for it to continue to exist, it needs a measure of legitimacy, of buy-in from its own people. The history of the Korean War helps, and the tweets from Donald Trump also help.
Very well said, and the book is very well written. It is called King of Spies, The Dark Reign of America's Spy Master in Korea. The author is Blaine Harden. Blaine, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, public protest against racist police brutality has been a beacon for all kinds of activists looking for ways to stand up to oppression, a model for those who want to go down on the right side of history with principled, persistent, and peaceful action in resistance to increasingly frightening reactionary exertions of state power. So into that context, we now introduce, by way of documents leaked to the magazine Foreign Policy, the FBI's designation of black identity extremists as a movement that constitutes a violent threat to public safety and warrants the surveillance and scrutiny of the country's counterterrorism forces. So what do we know about the definition of this term, black identity extremist? And more importantly, how does the FBI seem likely to apply it? The ACLU's racial justice program is on the case. We'll hear from lead attorney Nusrat Chaudhary. Also on the program, Amazon has just ended its request for proposals from U.S. cities jockeying to be the home of the megacorporation's second headquarters. We've seen jokey stories about what municipalities are offering as incentives, including being willing to change a town's name to Amazon. But what about the much less humorous considerations of what a city or state ought to be able to put on the block to woo a private corporation? And who ultimately comes out a winner in such deal-making? Village Voice News editor Neil DeMoss is author of The Brooklyn Wars and co-author of Field of Schemes, How the Great Stadium Swindle Turns Public Money into Private Profit. He'll be here to shed some light on the Amazon story. All of that's coming up, and we're going to get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Demonstrations continue in St. Louis, Missouri, over the acquittal of former St. Louis police officer Jason Stockley of first-degree murder charges in the 2011 killing of Anthony Lamar Smith. Very likely, some protesters would tell you they are distraught and angry, not just about this case, but about the undeniable fact that U.S. law enforcement rarely pay any penalty for murdering black people, whatever the circumstance. According to an FBI intelligence assessment recently leaked to Foreign Policy, that may make those people black identity extremists. The report, written up by Foreign Policy's Jana Winter and Sharon Weinberger, was dated August 3rd, 9 days before the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. The report assesses that, quote, it is very likely black identity extremist, BIE, perceptions of police brutality against African Americans spurred an increase in premeditated retaliatory lethal violence against law enforcement and will very likely serve as justification for such violence, close quote. Well, if that sounds to you like a setup, a pretense by which anyone protesting police brutality is ipso facto guilty of extremism, that calls for action by the counterterrorism division of the country's most powerful law enforcement, well, you aren't alone with those concerns. Nusrat Chaudhary is senior staff attorney at the ACLU's racial justice program. They're pursuing the issue. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Nusrat Chaudhary.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, what can we say about how the FBI seems to be defining black identity extremists and the vagueness of that term that we're all sort of laugh crying about? Could that be the point of it in some way?
Well, the report is disturbing on so many levels, not the least of which is that it's a red flag that the Bureau is once again profiling black activists because of their beliefs and their race. And, you know, we know that there's a long history in this country of the FBI using the fear of threats, real or perceived, as a cover for profiling black people, and in particular, black civil rights leaders and activists. This report doesn't make sense, and it raises that red flag that this is happening yet again to today's modern-day black civil rights movement leaders.
Well, I'm going to ask you a little about that history, but what on the face of it is what they're calling evidence for the existence of, I mean, the assessment says we're talking about criminal activity that's different from protected activity, but what is their evidence for the existence of a black identity extremist movement, you know, and then the definition of that is a violent movement?
Right. So the definition is so confusing that it's really hard to discern, but it seems to be circular. The FBI talks about 6 separate violent incidents in this internal report and then appears to assume, it literally, quote, makes a key assumption that those incidents were ideologically motivated. And then it even contradicts itself to acknowledge that those 6 incidents appear to have been influenced by more than one ideological perspective. Yet it concludes that there is some kind of unitary black identity extremist threat, I would say a so-called threat. And what this does is raise lots of questions from the public, from black people, black activists, and certainly the ACLU. And that's why the public needs to know, what does this term even mean? What's the basis for it? And what's the FBI doing after creating this designation? That's why we have joined with the Center for Media Justice in filing a Freedom of Information Act request seeking all documents that use this term, as well as other terms that have historically been used as a guise for surveilling black people and black activists.
Well, we know that the general public responds differently when you label something terrorism, when you label something extremism, and that impact is meaningful. You know, this sounds like kind of Alice in Wonderland. You know, if I stab you and you object, you are an anti-stabbing extremist, you know. But we know from history that a tool doesn't have to be precise to be used. You know, you don't have to sharpen a knife if you're going to use it as a club, you know. So what are the concerns about the way this new designation, even if everybody kind of scoffs at it, how do we think it might potentially be used?
Well, the FBI, when it releases a report like this internally, that kind of labeling of a so-called threat can be the basis for additional surveillance, investigations, and law enforcement activity. So creating this new label, even on the basis of these flawed assumptions, these conclusions that don't make sense on the face of the report, could lead to further surveillance and investigative activity, not just by the FBI, but even by other federal, state, and local law enforcement who share information with the FBI. So for good reason, black people and especially black activists are really concerned. They want to know, you know, what this is being used to do, and they have really good reasons to fear that it's going to be used to promote further law enforcement scrutiny of their First Amendment protected activities and even potentially result in racial profiling.
Well, you mentioned the relevant history here. Can you tell us some of that history which doesn't go, you know, it starts in the past, but it continues up to the present. What are some of the FBI's history in this regard that raise questions for folks?
Well, the federal government and the FBI in particular kept files on civil rights and anti-Vietnam War activists in the 1960s and 70s. We know that even more recently, since 9/11, the federal government, including the FBI, kept information on American Muslim civil rights leaders and academics. You know, as recently as 2005 and 2006, state law enforcement were exposed for infiltrating and monitoring peaceful political protests. So there's this history of targeting people because of their race as well as because of their beliefs, and often at that intersection are black activists. More recently, also American Muslim leaders and activists. This is a history we know so well, and the exposure of this report needs to be a catalyst to get more information and really just to demand that this stop.
Well, and I know folks will be thinking COINTELPRO, you know, which is, of course, you know, a program against black activists in the 50s and 60s and even into the 70s, most famously known for targeting Martin Luther King, but also taking aim at other civil rights organizations.
Absolutely. And that history is a long, sordid one. It has been exposed. It involved extensive surveillance of people who were deemed, quote, black extremists or, quote, black nationalists in that covert FBI COINTELPRO program. But creating a new label and just extending that type of surveillance to the modern day, we know what the harms are, and that's not what the federal government should be doing. We also know that people within federal, state, and local law enforcement have been raising concerns about far-right violence and about violence by white nationalists and white supremacists, those types of threats. So at a moment when there are many people in the intelligence community stating that those threats are on the rise, why is the FBI creating a new designation for a so-called threat of black identity extremists without sound methodology or conclusions that such a threat even exists?
Well, I certainly see the problem that a lot of folks are pointing out, saying that, you know, they're lumping together various groups. And I also, though, appreciate the comments of Hari Ziad on Afropunk. They talked about our desire to find a meaning in the violent, nonviolent distinction. And they said, you know, one of the cases that the assessment cites is Mika Johnson, who killed police officers. And they say, Ziad says, because there aren't too many Mika Johnsons, we reason, extremists like him can continue being unethically bombed by robots as long as we don't get bombed too. But black people always get bombed, literally and figuratively, in an anti-black world, and no amount of distance between us and black extremists will change that. In other words, the supposed safety that we're offered if we're not like those extreme black people doesn't exist. And it seems to me an important point, because I think, again, those who are not immediately impacted may buy the idea that they aren't going after black people, they aren't going after black activists, only violent people. And that seems an important distinction to kind of play with, or to at least interrogate.
I think that's right. And the public wants safety. People want law enforcement to focus on true threats and true threats of violence, right? But what the FBI is doing is talking about, quote, extremism. And what is that? People are allowed to have beliefs. And there's a lot of evidence out there that just having a radical or extreme idea does not show that people will actually engage in violent conduct. But using that label with broad brushstrokes and linking it to black identity is exactly the kind of overbroad categorization that can lead to racial profiling and targeting people because of their beliefs.
Well, finally, you note that the ACLU, along with the Center for Media Justice, have filed a FOIA request, a kind of what the heck is going on here request. What are you hoping to learn, and what's our way forward?
Well, this FOIA is a tool really for the public, and the Center for Media Justice, which consists of black activists and folks who are really at the forefront of doing that protest work, they are partners with us in this effort. We're hoping to get documents that will shed light on exactly how this term is being used, how often it's being used, what other types of investigations or surveillance have been conducted as a result of the creation of this kind of designation. And in the past, similar FOIA efforts have shown that the FBI has, you know, mapped racial and ethnic communities and given more insight into exactly what the FBI is doing with the dramatic and vast tools at its disposal. So we're hoping to get that information. If we don't, we will push for that information using the tools that the Freedom of Information Act provides.
We've been speaking with Nusrat Chaudhary from the ACLU Racial Justice Program. You can follow their work online at ACLU.org. Nusrat Chaudhary, thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me.
Amazon HQ2 bid deadline. Austin, Atlanta among contenders to watch. Does Sacramento have a real shot at Amazon HQ2? Pittsburgh ships its bid 2 inches thick to Amazon. As deadline approaches, Chicago's Amazon pursuit only beginning. Texas cities also woo Amazon with diversity, arts, and sunshine. That's just a taste of the headlines you may have seen. The intercity bidding war for the location of Amazon's second headquarters is a newsworthy phenomenon in itself. Hence, USA Today's four wildest stunts for Amazon's second headquarters. Well, we're joined now by Village Voice news editor, journalist Neil DeMoss. He's author most recently of the book The Brooklyn Wars and also co-author of Field of Schemes, How the Great Stadium Swindle Turns Public Money into Private Profit, which seems relevant here. He joins us now by phone from here in town. Welcome back to Counterspin, Neil DeMoss.
Always a pleasure.
Well, today, October 19th, is the deadline for the request for proposals from cities bidding to be the home of Amazon's second headquarters. Well, not everybody seems to be playing. The city of San Antonio wrote an open letter to Amazon's Jeff Bezos saying that the public courting for the new location is, quote, intentionally or not, creating a bidding war amongst states and cities, close quote. Now, I don't intend any shade at all to those San Antonio officials, but I do want to set that alongside the lead of a Wall Street Journal article that says, quote, the in-house economic development team shows how important tax incentive deals have become to Amazon's business model and gives a window into why the company took the step of pitting cities against each other to win the biggest subsidy package possible, close quote. In other words, it's entirely intentional. So San Antonio's being not naive, but maybe politic in implying that what Amazon is doing is somehow by the by and not, in fact, part of the playbook.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we're seeing here is following very much the playbook that Elon Musk used with the Tesla plant, right? Say, okay, everybody in the country, you've got a matter of weeks to pull together a bid. I'm open to anyone. I'll listen to anyone. And then I'll look them over and see who offers us the most goodies. And then maybe I'll go back and say to, you know, a city or a state, well, you're not the number one bidder here, but you could be. I think that clearly paid off for Musk and Tesla, you know, to the tune of $1.4 billion. So I'm not really surprised that Jeff Bezos and Amazon are looking at something similar here. And I think given what we're seeing from what's leaking out about some of the bids, which are not public for Amazon, it looks like they're going to be looking at some kind of tremendous taxpayer windfall as well.
Well, I wanted to ask you to describe some of the offers that we do know about. And then you cite in this piece in the Village Voice a not-for-public release addendum on New York City's bid, but these are public monies we're talking about, right? So first, why don't we know, and then what are some of the offers we should know about?
Basically, what we know about is what the cities and states want us to know about. So most of the bids that we've seen are, you know, playing up like New York's, for example. New York last night, finally, on the eve of the bid, released their plan, and their plan is all, New York is so great. New York has universities. New York has educated workforce. New York has transit. As someone who lives in New York, I don't know if bragging about the subways is the thing you want to do right now. But so in any case, you know, it just talks about that. And nowhere, anywhere there does it mention anything about what kind of subsidies the city or the state are going to offer, right? What kind of incentives? And that is all going to be communicated to Amazon outside of the public process and outside of the public eye. And I think that's what we're seeing in many places. And, you know, really we're relying a lot on states like New Jersey, where Chris Christie came out and openly sent a letter saying, you know, that he was going to double the available subsidies, per job subsidies that that the state could offer to relocating companies, which would, in Amazon's case, amount to something like $7 billion at minimum of public tax breaks that they would get kicked back. So, again, we don't know New Jersey's going to win. We don't know what the other bids are, but that gives us some idea of what kind of game is being played here and sort of what the ground rules are. I imagine that, you know, Governor Cuomo in New York and you know, other cities and states are all kind of at least have that in mind and are thinking, okay, to be in the game at all, we have to be talking probably 10 digits, not 9.
Well, what is the prize exactly that we're talking about here? I've seen a lot of reference to 50,000 jobs, but what do we know about these jobs? And what, again, for a deal to make sense, don't we have to understand the known relationship between these jobs and the contribution to the tax base that presumably would be being given up?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's not as bad a prize as, say, winning the Olympics, right? We've seen similar things where cities will spend billions of dollars to land the Olympics, and you get a whole lot of attention for 3 weeks, and then it goes away. To its credit, at least an Amazon headquarters does have people who are going to be working there day in and day out and shopping at local stores and eating at local restaurants and, you know, paying local taxes. So it is worth something. But the 50,000 jobs, I think, are going to roll out over 17 years. So you're not going to get them right at the start. Some of them won't come until the year 2034. Mm-hmm. And the bang for your buck, just when you're talking billions of dollars, is just not there. You know, you really want to keep per job cost at probably below $50,000 per job. You know, 10 or 20 would be better. But if you're under 50,000, you're at least maybe breaking even on your costs. If you're talking something that's going to cost billions of dollars for only 50,000 jobs, there's just no possible way it's going to pay it back.
Well, the New York Times had an expose a couple of years ago about the work culture of Amazon. It sounds like a real burn and churn atmosphere, lots of folks crying at their desks, you know, emails at midnight followed up by texts about why didn't you answer the email. There hasn't been a tremendous amount of critical reporting on their work culture, but what there is sounds like maybe if, as a mayor, you're trying to decide what kind of jobs, what kind of industry you want to bring to your town, maybe this isn't the first one, you know, a one where infamously in Allentown, Pennsylvania, an Amazon outlet warehouse had temperatures over 100 degrees and just had ambulances lined up outside to carry away workers when they fell. And after there was reporting on them, they decided to install air conditioners. It sounds a little bit like a cult and not a very fun cult. But Amazon's a private company. You know, Amazon can do what Amazon wants. My question is, where is the public responsibility come in when we have elected officials talking about being eager to bring a certain kind of industry to their town? I guess I'm just asking again, doesn't the public have some right to know here when there are public monies being used as bait?
Yeah, and that's the disturbing thing, right, is that all of this bidding is happening behind closed doors, aside from, again, whatever the press releases are that the cities and states are willing to put out. So you don't have the opportunity to vet what states or cities are offering with public dollars, right? Or what the promises are from Amazon that they would, you know, provide in exchange. You know, how good are the jobs going to be? How long are they going to last? What will be the impact on other jobs, right? I mean, you know, if you're helping out Amazon by boosting their profits and giving them a leg up, you know, in the retail world, is that going to hurt other businesses that exist in a city, right? This is why I think, you know, that sort of litany of horse race coverage, you know, who's going to win Amazon that you read at the top of the segment is so worrisome, because the hope is that when something like this gets announced, you're actually going to see the press go out there and investigate and try and figure out, okay, what is being offered? What is a city going to get in exchange? And it really is not what's happening, because both Amazon and the bidders, the public bidders here, are keeping everything close to the vest. And I think it's been very easy to just instead say, oh, hey, look, here's a town that's promising to change its name to Amazon. Isn't that funny?
Right, right. Well, and then finally, it's not like there's no record here. You know, Amazon has opened up outlets outside of their HQ in Seattle. They have a record in other cities and in other places. You note in your Village Voice piece that maybe if New York doesn't win, despite coloring the Empire State Building orange in the hopes of winning the account, if New York City doesn't win, it might not be the worst thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think my concern here and what the message that I kind of took away from researching the article is that the winner of the Amazon headquarters might end up being the biggest loser, because, you know, you are going to be on the hook for so much in costs just to be able to be in the bidding, right? That won't necessarily get you the prize. But when you look at Tesla and how Nevada originally came in and said, well, you know, we'll give you a little bit of incentives, and Musk came back and said, well, you're like $900 million off. You've got to come up with a lot more money. And they wound up coming up with a lot more money. It's just a bad way to do business for if you're a local government. You know, it's much better to try to build a strong, traffic and transit system, to try and build, a strong school system and all the things that build a diverse business base, rather than throwing a whole lot of money at one company in the hopes that, hey, maybe, you know, we'll get some big glitzy thing that will at least we'll put our name on the front page. But I think like there's an element where there are so few big companies right now that there's a real idea, especially in a lot of cities, you know, that are not New York, of, wow, we could be the home of one of the four companies that people have still heard of.
Right.
And, you know, this is what really is driving the bidding war so crazy. You know, what Greg LeRoy talks about is that you're seeing these crazy numbers being thrown around because, you know, it's not like there's another company down the road that you can say, well, if we don't get Amazon, we'll just get, you know, the second best thing to Amazon, because there is no second best thing to Amazon.
Right.
You know, it's Amazon or the highway.
Right.
And I certainly think that the highway is a much better economic model because you don't have to pay for it. But, you know, it's not like there's an Amazon Junior out there that you can go bid for instead.
It's so funny that we, though, have this idea that this private public, it's a real division. Private, they do it on their own, you know? They just mm-hmm. they just go out there and do it. But, you know, you have to give them taxpayer money or else they won't go out there and do it independently,
right.
Privately.
Yeah, it's the same thing with stadiums and the Olympics or whatever. It's just it just suddenly becomes the, well, you know, they're going to build it somewhere. And if you want it to be us, then we, you know, have to be willing to play the game. They're private and self-reliant until the minute that they don't have to be.
We've been speaking with Neil DeMoss, news editor at The Village Voice, author most recently of The Brooklyn Wars, and co-author of Field of Schemes. His article, What's It Really Worth to Have Amazon Come to Town?, appears on villagevoice.com. Neil DeMoss, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Sure thing.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show, or you'd like to hear previous shows or see transcripts of interviews, you can find all of that on FAIR.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The verdict is in from space and from ground. The world's tropical forests are releasing their masses of carbon into an already overloaded atmosphere. It's a climate signal as big as the meltback of Arctic sea ice in 2007. You will hear breaking science from NASA and Woods Hole. In the face of inevitable disasters to come, we also have Daniel Lurch from the Post-Carbon Institute. He will talk about resilience in a time of upheaval. I'm Alex Smith with three new interviews. Let's get going.
Radio EcoShock.
While we live and sleep, in space, NASA operates an Orbiting Carbon Observatory, or OCO. Actually, this is version 2, launched in 2014, after the first one malfunctioned during deployment in 2009. Now scientists have announced a wave of new findings about the way carbon works in our atmosphere. In times of rapid climate change, this is need-to-know information. Actually, NASA has released 5 studies in one, I think, from 21 scientists, by my count. It's huge, and it's all published in the journal Science on October 13th. Fortunately, we have as our guide a lead author with an overview. She is Dr. Anne-Marie Eldering with the Carbon Observatory Project. From the NASA Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California, Anne-Marie, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Nice to be here.
Well, the paper is titled The Orbiting Carbon Observatory 2, Early Science Investigations of Regional Carbon Dioxide Fluxes. But help me out, Anne-Marie. Is this one paper or five?
So this is a collection of five papers with the overview I wrote and then four distinct findings. But we highlight the paper about the atmospheric fluxes because that's really the science question OCS2 was designed to go after.
I've been speaking with other scientists about carbon loss from tropical forests, and it's a huge topic. There's some new carbon news that you people have brought out. And I was talking with Alessandro Bacini, for example, from the Woods Hole Research Center, and his new study in the journal Science. And it's worrying for climate and forest activists to think that the tropical forests are losing carbon. So let's explore that study by Junji Liu et al. Please tell us about the great cycle of plants and carbon during the year.
Okay, so a little bit of background. As you know, the plants are an important regulator of the seasonal cycle of atmospheric carbon dioxide. They take it up and release it and put a big seasonal cycle pattern into the record that we have of CO2. And they're also very important because humans are emitting carbon dioxide, and the land and the ocean take up about half of what gets emitted every year. So in effect, dampening the impact of what we add to the atmosphere. And we were fortunate once OCO2 was launched in 2014, not that long after, one of the largest El Niños on record got started, the El Niño of 2015-2016. So this was like a big natural experiment. What happens when there's more heat and more drought? How are the plants going to respond? And we saw the largest increase in the atmospheric CO2 growth rate that we've ever seen, in fact, in 10,000 years. And we now can explain why that happened based on the work that Junji's team did to explore the tropics and their response to the El Niño conditions and to the heat and the drought.
This study by Liu reveals the biosphere lost 2.5 gigatons more carbon from the tropics in 2015 than just 4 years earlier in 2011. And to me, that is stunning. And can you talk to us about why that happened?
Definitely. So she studied 2015, which was the big El Niño year, relative to 2011, which was more like a normal year, and indeed found this 2.5 gigatons of carbon released. And when she looked at it in detail, what she found was that there were three tropical regions that released extra carbon: the tropical parts of South America, Africa, and then Indonesia. And in fact, they all had a different reason for releasing extra carbon. In South America, there was much less rain. It was a drought, one of the biggest droughts in 30 years. And so the plants just didn't grow as much as they normally do. Therefore, they didn't remove carbon dioxide, and you had extra in the atmosphere. In Africa, it was a different story. The plants grew as normal, but it was very, very warm. So a lot of the material on the ground, the dead leaves, and decomposed very rapidly, and that released the carbon dioxide. In Indonesia, you're probably aware that there were some very large peat fires in that time period, and that was the biggest source of carbon dioxide. So we had three different effects happening in those three different regions.
And two of those from the El Niño or during the El Niño are the same conditions projected to become more regular as climate change develops. What does that tell us, Anne-Marie, about the future role of tropical forests as regulators of atmospheric carbon?
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head. We're very interested in the implications that, indeed, about 30% of the climate models predict heat and drought conditions in the future that are similar to what we see in El Niño. And this work shows that less carbon gets taken up by tropical land, so you're going to have more rapid increased rates of carbon dioxide because the land won't do as much as it's doing right now to help remove that.
Are we talking about a positive feedback mechanism from the tropics now, where increasing carbon loss drives increasing carbon loss?
That is indeed the implication of this work.
And I guess this is outside the scope of the work, but the usual solutions, I suppose, that humans could take to reduce carbon loss from the tropics, what can we do?
Well, I think the work we're focused on about the natural cycles are something that we're not going to have much influence on. So it's really about learning what those natural cycles might do, understanding the implications, and then as we think about our plans and how we will manage carbon in the future, it's important to know that something like this positive feedback could be happening. I think we maybe had a lot of uncertainty. It was hard to make some decisions around this issue, but if we can reduce uncertainty with work like this, it could help us make some better plans down the road.
Now, you're in California during the mega fires as we speak, and I'm wondering if those fires are kind of a small reflection of the data coming in from these satellite observations. And I want to ask you a second question along those lines. How does that relate to the study led by Florian Schwander about observations of Los Angeles taken from space?
Yeah, so you're right. I'm in California and we're having some huge fires right now. We actually just had a discussion that the magnitudes of these fires are actually quite small when you think about the comparison to, say, what happens in Africa and Indonesia. So we may see a little signal, but it's quite small, factor of 10 to 50 less being emitted in these types of things. Florian's study about Los Angeles was quite interesting. We definitely have information about how the carbon dioxide in cities is higher than the background. People have told us about this from ground-based stations and from other remote sensing measurements. But the real value in what Florian showed was that with just a few minutes of measurements from OCO2, you see this contrast of the enhanced carbon dioxide elevated by 4, 5, 6 parts per million in Los Angeles relative to the background. So it really demonstrates the capability of the remote sensing technique that OCO2 uses. And that was one of the goals of this mission, to really show we in fact can see small changes. We can see these gradients over small areas. And now that we see this technique work so well, it can help us imagine the future and think about directions we can go.
Well, maybe in the future we'll be able to look at a map or check our phones and find out what our current carbon emissions are in the city where we live.
That's a great goal to have as we move down the road.
All right. Now, another study in this package by Abhishek Chatterjee talks about, quote, a near total shutdown of sea-to-air flux of carbon during the 2015-2016 boreal winter. What does that mean, and should we worry about it?
So Abhishek studied the equatorial Pacific Ocean, and he was following up on a hypothesis that people had that when El Nino occurred, the ocean circulation changes a bit. So there's a water in the ocean that's very cold and holds a lot of carbon, and typically it upwells in this equatorial Pacific region and releases some of that carbon to the atmosphere. And in El Nino condition, you don't have that same upwelling, and therefore you don't have the same release of carbon into the atmosphere. So Abhishek looked at our data and sees a nice time series of how this capping of the upwelling was happening, and for a few months you saw a decrease of about 1%, half a part per million in the carbon dioxide over the ocean area. And then as time went on, that signal was overwhelmed by what was happening on the land. And so I think this again is valuable in seeing how response of the ocean is happening, and again trying to think about the future and our best prediction of what might happen. Certainly the ocean is another important buffer in holding on to the carbon dioxide that we emit into the atmosphere, but if there's some changes in the temperatures and the circulation, we certainly expect that there'll be some changes in the carbon storage.
Now, another topic we've been talking with scientists about here on Radio EcoShock is about how volcanoes can cool global weather for the short term, a year or more, versus that longer-term greenhouse gas emissions from the same eruption. It's still a bit murky to me. What do we know about that, and does the Orbiting Carbon Observatory help clear up that question?
Yeah, so volcanoes are always an interesting thing, and they're a big event at the moment they happen, but they usually don't last too long. So when you put together your budget of all the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you must account for them, but they're a pretty small player in the global sense. But for people like Florian Schwander, who led this paper, his main scientific interest is volcanoes, and no one had really shown how much carbon dioxide they release in a remote sensing measurement before. So he was able to show that you can see the plumes of emissions from the volcanoes. You can even estimate the amount of carbon dioxide they're releasing, and it makes sense with other estimates people have developed. So it's really, again, demonstrating we have the precision We don't see a lot of the Earth. We only sample about 6% of the mass of the land over our 16-day repeat cycle. But in the instances where we flew over these points of interest, he actually was able to get a quantified estimate of the release from the volcanoes. So it's good to help us test our models and see if we have a good understanding. And if a future data set had a denser set of samples, it might be able to provide that type of information for a larger set of these types of sources.
Okay, so you brought up something really interesting. What does this satellite offer that other related satellites can't or don't do?
So the big advance that OCO2 has made is this small footprint and high density of data. In the time frame of the original OCO mission, the Japanese launched something called GOSAT, and it's a measurement of greenhouse gases. GOSAT has shown to provide a lot of value to the scientific community, but it provides about 1/100th of the data density compared to OCO2. And in addition, we have a little bit better precision on our data than GOSAT did. So in finding some of the sources and sinks and quantifying the natural processes that are happening, the additional density of the OCO2 data is providing us the ability to see these sources and quantify them on a smaller scale compared to what we ever did before. So I think we can see smaller sources and we can work on smaller areas than we ever did before with these kind of data sets.
I'm hearing an echo from the Cold War when the first satellites were developed and they got more and more accurate to where it was said they could pick out a shovel in a backyard in Russia. And now we're getting to that point with carbon in the atmosphere. That's pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah, we're not quite at the shovel scale, but we're certainly at the your neighborhood scale for a single measurement. It's interesting.
You're listening to New Science on Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Anne-Marie Eldering from the NASA Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California. Your study, the one that you led, helps us understand that big picture of how carbon changes in the atmosphere due to plants. I'm wondering, am I correct to assume that because there's a bigger land mass, plants in the northern hemisphere have a greater impact on the atmosphere, or do algae in the great oceans of the southern hemisphere balance that out somehow?
No, that's a very interesting question. What we have seen in our data set, as well as in some of the records before us, is that in the northern hemisphere, you have two important influences that really lead to a lot of dynamic changes over the year. You have the plants that grow in the spring and draw a lot of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere very, very rapidly. And then you also have a lot of the human population of the world, which is continuing to emit carbon dioxide. So you have increasing concentrations in the winter as the emissions build up, and then rapid decrease in spring and summer as the plants remove a lot of carbon dioxide. So you have this up and down cycle in the northern hemisphere that's very strong. It's order 10 parts per million. And in the southern hemisphere, when you look at the time record, it's much, much flatter because the land mass is smaller. The plants don't have that big influence. The number of humans and the emissions there are much smaller. So you have more like a kind of constant creeping up of concentration that's just due to this mixing of everything around the globe. So what happens in the northern hemisphere eventually mixing down into the southern hemisphere and bringing a rising concentration over time.
But can the Orbiting Carbon Observatory 2 measure changes in emissions by ocean algae, and should we expect more science to come out on that?
So that's a great question. The ocean fluxes are actually quite small, and in our current assessment, most of the ocean changes will be very hard for us to detect. It might be if a big event happens or we have a long enough time series, we can start to eke some of that out. But at our current understanding is that the land exchange will be the most evident signal and the first one the scientists will really be able to quantify. And big changes in the ocean don't happen that often, so it'll be a harder problem to get numbers for.
I have to admit, I found assessing five studies at once a bit daunting. Would you just take a few minutes or as long as you need and tell us about some of the other important results from this latest publication?
I would love to. Yeah, we decided that five papers at once might have a more of an impact, but it certainly can be a lot to try to get through. So we talked about Junji's studies of the tropical land masses, and I mentioned Abhishek's analysis of how the oceans responded. Florian's work on the volcanoes and on looking at the city quantification, again, is a nice demonstration of the precision and sensitivity that we have with this data set. And the other piece of work that's included here is one on solar-induced fluorescence. So it turns out that satellites that measure the particular wavelength of light capture a little bit of light that's being emitted by plants while they perform photosynthesis. So OCO2 is able to quantify that signal and see the activity of the plants. And the direction that people are going with that data set is trying to understand its relationship to the gross primary productivity, or kind of how much plant material is being produced. And in the past, we've seen that there's some sort of a linear relationship between the SIF measurement and GPP, but it's never been clear if there's a universal relationship or it changes with a different type of plants. And now that we have OCO2 data that has small footprints, it's very precise, and it can be compared in a very direct way to the flux towers, which is the ground-based way we measure this primary productivity. Ying has shown that, in fact, these are very linearly related across all of the different types of plants that she studied. So this is giving us further evidence that the measurement we have from space is closely related to a characteristic we care about and can help us understand the plant's behaviors and responses. Again, when Junji studied how the heat and the drought of El Nino impacted the tropical regions, the solar-induced fluorescence was one of the measurement data sets she used. She used carbon dioxide, water, in precipitation, the temperature, the SIF signal, and carbon monoxide that's measured by another instrument but tells her something about fire. So these data sets all actually link together.
You had me back at the idea that plants emit light when they perform photosynthesis. I had no idea that happened.
Yeah, there's a many scientists who spend time in the field with little spectrometers and look at this light, and even some of the so there's many signals that people have been looking at that are related to this, but you can actually see a very specific pattern of light that plants do emit, and it's detectable just as a small change of a few percent in the measurements that we have.
Wow. Well, I see that NASA's Goddard Earth Science Data Center provides a lot of this carbon data from the satellites to the public at three levels, I'm reading, and from massive detail to global maps of carbon dioxide. I think most of our listeners would settle for the maps. Do you have any way that we can find them?
Yeah, we've tried to make it easy because we love to get our data into everybody's hands. So if they go to our website, oco2.jpl.nasa.gov, from the main menu, you can find a gallery of videos and of stills. And in those collections, you'll find time series maps of our data that they can browse and review, as well as a few details about how we make our measurement and how our instrument's built.
I see you're also a project scientist with OCO3. What is going on with that?
Well, if you got a good thing going, just keep going with it, is my thinking. So we were fortunate after the loss of OCO, NASA realized this was an important measurement, so they allowed us to move forward with the OCO2 project, or a rebuild of that same instrument. And while we did that, it was decided to build a spare one just in case some other problems happened. So after OCO2 was launched successfully, we worked with NASA to develop a plan for continuing our measurement record of carbon dioxide. So that spare instrument's being wrapped up in a way that's compatible with the International Space Station. And the plan is that we would install this on the International Space Station maybe next year, and then continue to have more measurements of atmospheric carbon dioxide.
You get another wow for that. I'm really looking forward to it. We've been talking about another huge science release, this time a collection of five studies based on results from NASA's Orbiting Carbon Observatory 2, also known as OCO2. And all that was published in the journal Science on October 13, 2017. You can find links to this whole discussion in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Our guide has been Dr. Anne-Marie Eldering, a project scientist with the Orbiting Carbon Observatory Project. Anne-Marie, thanks so much for taking time to talk with us.
Thanks for your interest.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
For a very long time, carbon has been taken out of the atmosphere by the plant world, and we count on those services from the vast fabric of tropical rainforests. But all that has changed. New science proves tropical forests are a net carbon source. Our guest, Alessandro Baccini, is the lead author of that paper, published September 28th in the journal Science. Dr. Baccini works at the Woods Hole Research Center. He specializes in analyzing Earth from space using satellites. From Massachusetts, Alessandro, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
When you worked at the Food and Agriculture Organization at the United Nations in the 90s, what was the assumption about the role of tropical forests and atmospheric carbon?
At that time, most of the information that we had about the role of forests in the carbon cycle was coming from what each country actually knew about their forests. And as you can understand that some of the tropical countries, given the limitation in resources, it was very difficult for them to have a good assessment of the amount of forest, amount of carbon stored in the vegetation. So we had to work with a lot of assumptions and in some ways not the best information to come up with an assessment. But overall, the general understanding is that forests, through the photosynthesis, are able to absorb CO2 from the atmosphere, right, and release oxygen. And this exchange has been usually positive in the sense that there was more removal from the atmosphere than the emissions. And let me just be clear about what we intend by emissions from forests, right? Emissions from forests don't happen when you cut a tree, right? It's not that it's like a water pipe, that you cut the pipe and then the water is going to leak out. That's not how the emission, the carbon, the CO2 goes into the atmosphere. But in the case of forests, it's through the process of decomposition of the wood, of the timber, because timber is made of biomass and 50% of that is actually carbon. So when the wood decomposes, that carbon that is stored in the tree, in the wood, will at some point go back into the atmosphere. It could be a very slow process in case of a natural decay, or it could be very fast in case, for example, of fire. If there is a forest fire, the wood, the carbon that is stored in that wood will go into the atmosphere right away. Right? That's a process that releases carbon into the atmosphere from forests. And what we presented in this new study is that there is so much pressure in the forest, in the tropics, there is so much loss and disturbance that the amount of carbon that goes into the atmosphere is bigger than the amount of carbon that the forests are able to remove. It's not that the forests are not removing anymore the carbon. It's just that forests are less and less. And so the ability to remove this carbon from the atmosphere is becoming much smaller at the point that there is more emission than amount of carbon that is possible to remove.
Well, just so we know where we stand, do current climate models, like those used by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, do they assume forests are a carbon sink or a net carbon source?
It depends on the studies. For example, our studies, for the period of our study that is between the year 2003 and 2014, we actually show that tropical forest has always been a source. Okay, it has never been a sink in this period. In some studies, actually, it has been shown the opposite, that forest before was a significant sink, meaning that it was able to remove more carbon than the carbon that was emitted as a result of deforestation and the degradation. So it depends. It depends which study you are actually consider. And what we like to think is that with this new paper, we provide an independent assessment, a data-driven, measurement-based assessment of what the tropical forests are. Are they a source or are they a sink? And especially because with this study, we are able to report on all different types of disturbances. It's not only emissions from deforestation, but are also emissions from degradation. That is a process that until now has been very difficult to quantify over such a large area.
Now, Alessandro, what techniques did you and your team use to settle this debate?
We use a combination of field data and satellite observation. What we do is that we actually go in the field, we went in the field, and in specific location, we collected measurements in the forest of what the carbon in this forest is. And then we use this information to calibrate the measurements and the signal that we receive from satellites, that they provide images of the Earth, in this case, every 2 days. And then when we are able to calibrate those signals with the information on the ground, then through a statistical model, we are able to generate estimate of what the carbon is wherever we have information from the satellite. And so we find that this is a very cost-effective way to do it, because satellite observation are able to cover a very, very large area at an extremely low cost. And in this case, actually, the cost was zero because we use data that are free, that are available for free. And that was the goal of our study, because we want countries and users and the community to be able to reproduce this data, this exercise, and improve it without having to start with the data acquisition. The data that we use and the software, the code that we use is open source, so it is all free.
How can listeners find out where that is or what it's called?
The satellite data that we use are recorded from the U.S. NASA satellite. It's called MODIS. It has been a very successful program. And if you just Google MODIS, you can go and download the data. The other sensor that we use is a sensor that provides laser measurements of the vegetation. What this sensor provides is information on the vertical structure of the vegetation, so how tall the trees are. And this is it's called ISAT glass, was a sensor designed to measure the thickness in ice. But the information that collects actually, if properly processed, can be useful for vegetation studies too. And so those data are all free. But of course, part of the hard work in our case was to process this information, because if you just take the information as it is, you will not be able to repeat exactly what we did. So there is a series of processing that needs to be done to the data. If you're interested in the result, you can find the results at www.thecarbonsource.org. It's a website where we post all the data, and you can go there and download the data for the tropics.
Great. I love that. Now, according to your new study, Alessandro, how much carbon is being lost every year from tropical forests?
Our study is indicating that the net loss in tropical forest is 425 petagrams of carbon per year. And that is, just to give you an idea, it's pretty much the amount of emission that cars and trucks in the U.S. are responsible for.
That sounds like a lot to me. I wonder, on our current trajectory, do you think the net loss of carbon from the world's tropical rainforests will grow? And if so, do we know what that rate of increase might be?
That's a very interesting question. And what we find is that forest is under a increasing pressure, meaning that deforestation and disturbance are resulting in a higher stress into the system. And so unless there is a big shift, a big change, we probably expect this to continue and to probably increase. So that means that we might have a larger source, meaning that we will have less and less forest. And so less and less forest means less and less ability of this system to remove carbon from the atmosphere. But there are activities and there is interest at the international level to actually try to stop or to slow down this process. And one positive aspect of our study is that, you know, while we show that tropical forests are a source, well, that means also that if we can invert that process and make tropics a sink, that means that we will be able to remove a lot of CO2 from the atmosphere and have a positive impact on the climate. And right now, that is, I would say, the only technology that is ready, safe, and available for such a large scale. So, you know, yes, right now forests are a source, but hey, let's try to invert that, make forests a sink. And to do that, we need to stop the deforestation, go back and restore forest and landscape that have been degraded. And yes, the old saying, let's just plant trees where we can and let them grow. Because as they grow, they remove carbon from the atmosphere and they will store it in the forest.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking about alarming new science about our tropical forests emitting more carbon to the atmosphere. Our guest from the Woods Hole Research Center is scientist Dr. Alessandro Baccini. Can we assume that global warming itself may further damage the forests, thus creating a positive feedback loop?
That is a concern that we have, and some of our data are actually showing that, yes, there is a negative feedback. And what that negative feedback is, for example, we see in some regions in Brazil, is that a series of droughts that happen every 2 or 3 years in the past 12 years are resulting in an increase in mortality within the forest. So there are some species that are not able to react to the lack of rain, and so some of the trees then will start to die. As that happens, also the condition for fires improve, meaning that there is more fuel wood in the forest, there is less humidity, so the condition for fires are much better. So we see also an increase in the frequency of fires. And as the frequency of fires increase, there is, you know, more loss in forests, more loss in biomass, and so the emissions to the atmosphere are increasing.
And beyond the Amazon, which we may have heard about, what other threatened tropical forests did your satellite study find?
Well, the study really focused on the Amazon, on the above-ground woody vegetation. And so the main threats are, yes, some are anthropogenic, so logging and selective logging. But we also find biomass loss due to natural drivers, such as I mentioned, fires or drought or insects that are also some of the threats. We are now trying to expand the study outside of the tropics to see what the process and what the carbon balance is for the regions outside of the tropics.
Alessandro, what research would you like to take on next?
I would like to try if we can improve the information that we can derive from satellite. And what that means is that we would like to work with satellites that provide more spatial details. The resolution of our data right now is at 500 meters, meaning that we can provide an estimate for an area on the ground of 500 meters by 500 meters, and that sometimes could be a little bit coarse. What we would like to do is to improve it to 30 meters by 30 meters. There is a sensor that is called Landsat, and that will provide this type of analysis. It's just that the amount of computation is a big challenge, but that is something that we would like to do next.
The title of the paper we've been talking about is Tropical Forests Are a Net Carbon Source Based on Above-Ground Measurements of Gain and Loss, as published September 28, 2017. From the Woods Hole Research Center, our guest is the lead author, Dr. Alessandro Baccini. You can find links to follow up on this discussion in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Alessandro, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Resilience is a key word for a spectrum of people, starting with collapsnicks all the way to big city mayors and regional planners. But what is it? Has anybody thought this through? Enter the Community Resilience Reader from the Post-Carbon Institute. It's billed as essential resources for an era of upheaval. We certainly have the upheaval. I've reached the book's editor and co-author, Daniel Lurch. Daniel was featured on Radio EcoShock in 2009 from a conference called Gaining Ground, Resilient Cities. He's been on this beat ever since. From Guadalajara, Mexico, Daniel Lurch, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thank you for having me, Alex. It's good to be here.
Let's start with a no-nonsense scholar from British Columbia, Dr. William Reese. Bill contributes a chapter that asks what we all wonder, does human nature drive us toward collapse? Daniel, talk to us about our apparent inability to steer away from that cliff.
Oh, boy. Well, I guess with any issue in this book, there's going to be hours worth of conversation to unpack it, and you managed to select the one chapter that's probably the most complex. Bill Reese's chapter, so and for folks who don't recognize his name, Bill Reese is the co-originator of the ecological footprint concept. Everyone's probably heard of the ecological footprint at this point. Bill Reese put that together back in the 90s with his a graduate student, his Matisse Walker-Nagel. Bill is a fellow of Post-Carbon. He contributed a great chapter on our previous reader in 2010, the Post-Carbon Reader. That chapter was about resilience, but also kind of touched on these same issues about just the human nature. What is it about human nature that kind of makes us, as he puts it, an unsustainable species, more or less? And what Bill's talking about with that notion of unsustainability of human nature is, you know, and again, it's not a value judgment. It's not saying that humans are bad or evil. He's simply looking at the biology, the evolutionary biology of us as a species, and noting that there are things in us and the way that our brains work, the way that we've evolved, that are, in the context of modern industrial society, kind of maladaptive. They just don't work very well. It worked great for getting us out of the savanna and for making us a very successful species that could, you know, end up spreading across the world. But now, as we're reaching 7.5 billion people, some of those things that led our species to success are starting to foul the nest, if you want to put it that way. So some of the things that he talks about, for example, he describes in the beginning of this chapter, the roots of our crises, does human nature drive us to collapse? He starts by describing Homo sapiens as what's called a patch disturbance species, and there's other animals that are like this, and it's basically an animal that will disturb a central area, kind of its camp, if you will, but will also disturb a much larger area as it goes out and forages and gets the resources that it needs. I'm not a biologist, so I can't think of an example in the animal kingdom of that, but you know, you can probably imagine that large warm-blooded animals tend to do that. So think about that as that works now with humanity and human society. We've gone from occupying, you know, say that small patch around a cave, you know, however many hundreds of thousands of years ago, and foraging into the woods, hunting game, picking, collecting edible plants and whatnot, causing some small-scale disturbance, but, you know, not a whole lot. But now with 7.5 billion people, we're obviously disturbing the entire globe because of just, you know, something, because this is simply the way that human nature works. We go out, we get resources, and we tend to take a lot. We leave a very big footprint. That's one example of what Bill is talking about. He also gets into things like just how our neurology works. And we have, you know, if you think about the way that we evolve in small groups, where, for example, perhaps the individual early human who was very aggressive, who only thought for himself, who was, you know, perhaps selfish in some ways, that one was going to probably be the most successful because he would have gotten the most resources and the most, and he would have successfully made it. Bill makes an interesting observation that, you know, those sorts of behaviors are adaptive at an individual level, but are maladaptive at a collective level. If you have those same sorts of behaviors, but you're talking about a larger society, you know, obviously it doesn't work very well to have an entire society full of aggressive, selfish thinking people. So those are the kinds of things that Bill talks about in this chapter, and we included it in the book because we felt it was important to recognize that when we're talking about sustainability, when we're talking about resilience, it's not enough just to look at laws and policies and the purchasing decisions that we make as humans. We really need to think about, why do we do the things that we do, whether as individuals or as families or as communities. So this chapter, essentially on neuroscience and biology, was really essential to us to include in this book.
It's hard to give specific step-by-step plans when the menu of possible threats is so great. I mean, we've got everything from, well, nuclear weapons, we hope not, but we do have climate change and natural disasters, if there are any natural disasters these days. Daniel Lurch, how can we develop a toolbox for such a big range of possible disruptions?
Yeah, another big question. I mean, that's kind of how it is when we talk about resilience. Let me back up there a little bit and see if I can approach this in a way that's gonna be useful. Part of why we talk about resilience in this book, and why we talk about resilience in Post-Carbon Institute as a concept, is this idea that we face so many crises, we face so many challenges as a society, as individuals, that it simply doesn't work anymore to think of them in the way that we've thought about sustainability issues, say, over the last 30 years, where we say, we imagine the ideal outcome that we want to achieve, and then we kind of backcast and figure out, okay, what do we need to do to get to that outcome? So, for example, say we decide, well, we want to run everything off of wind and solar power. Okay, well, let's go backwards and see what are the things that we need to change in order to do that. We need to get electric cars, we need to change the power plants, that sort of thing. That's a perfectly valid way of approaching an issue, but obviously it's also very compartmentalized. It's very linear. And reality, any reality in this world obviously is complex, and when we get to sustainability crises, they're particularly complex. One of the reasons why we tend to use the word complex as opposed to complicated, for example, is that a complex problem has emergent properties, things that pop up that are really unpredictable. It has influences from outside the system. It has processes inside the system. If you're looking at a complex set of problems or any sort of complex system, you can't just, again, aim for a particular outcome and try to figure out the right recipe or the right menu to get there. It just doesn't work that way. One of the sets of authors in our book, Brian Walker and David Salt, they essentially wrote the book on resilience science, that is, for lay people. And one of the examples that they give in describing this idea of complexity is that something that's complicated just think of like a Swiss watch. There's a lot going on in there. There are a lot of moving parts. But you can essentially take it apart, look at it, figure out how it works, put it back together again, and it'll work the way that it did before. Complexity is very different. Complexity, like I said, is there's aspects, there are emergent properties, and an emergent property is essentially something that kind of happens or kind of is created or arises when other things are coming together, and it's not necessarily predictable. So to get back to this idea, why do we talk about resilience instead of sustainability, and why do we not necessarily go for the typical sustainability toolkit, as you mentioned, is that resilience science is focused on understanding the processes of how systems work. Another author and a scientist I respect very much, Charles Redman at Arizona State University, he wrote a very influential article a couple of years ago describing this connection, the relationship between sustainability and resilience. And he's the one that kind of pointed out very clearly that sustainability as a practice tends to prioritize outcomes. Again, like let's get to 50% renewable energy or let's all drive Priuses or something. Whereas resilient science prioritizes process. Resilient science gets us thinking about, okay, why does this system work the way that it does? What are the characteristics of this system that lead to certain responses? Again, and value neutral, it doesn't matter if it's, you know, if it's good or bad, that assessment comes later, but just trying to understand what's happening and why so that we can then knowingly and in an informed manner make some decisions about how to change that system. So when it comes to the toolbox then, you know, the tools that we need for doing resilience work, for trying to build the resilience of the systems that we care about, they're essentially systems thinking tools. They're tools that help us think about, well, if this one portion of this system, and again, when I say system, it could be anything. It could be an ecosystem. It could be an urban community. It could be something as small as, you know, a garden. It could be something as large as a subway system or a regional economy or whatever. Systems thinking helps us look at these things, and it gives us mental tools for understanding, okay, well, when this happens and this next thing happens, it has this response. But these other sets of things happen, and there's a different response. So we start using terms like, okay, well, there's a feedback loop happening over here. There's a stock over here and a flow over here. And we don't have time to get into a crash course in systems thinking. But those are the kinds of tools that we need to start using. You know, they're mental tools. Obviously, we also need to have, I guess, what you could call manual skills or more practical skills as well. Because once we start thinking about, you know, what's happening and say, in my community, why does my community work the way that it does, and I want to change it. Well, if I want to change it, then maybe I need some skills like group facilitation, you know, public speaking, group organizing, or getting out there and you know, learning how to do repairs and you know, gardening and whatever else, and all the different grassroots kinds of activist things that have been happening in American communities for the last 30 years or so. So I guess that's kind of the long answer to your question. What toolkit do we need? I would say it's both the practical toolkit, but especially the mental toolkit, the toolkit of systems thinking.
I totally agree, but I do disagree, and this is just a minor point, with one definition of resilience given by the co-authors Brian Walker and David Salt. They write, quote, "Put simply, resilience is the ability to cope with shocks and keep functioning in much the same way as before." But of course, I think we definitely should not aim to keep functioning as before. I mean, we don't want to keep rebuilding roads and going on with business as usual because that's killing the planet. Maybe we don't need to bounce back. Maybe we need to bounce forward or bounce very differently. Is that a concept covered by resilience?
Oh, absolutely. And that particular definition from Brian Walker and David Salt, that is their put simply definition. I mean, in that chapter, and in their other writings, they describe, I think, very clearly and very eloquently how, again, resilient science is, at its most basic, you can use it to try to get your system to respond to disruption and to go back to the way it was working. But also part of resilience thinking is understanding, you know, as I said, why do things work the way they do? How can we change that? And we can use that information then to change things for the better if we want to. For example, there's a concept in resilience science called transformability. And that has to do with when a system experiences a large disruption, if it's kind of the classic example is a forest experiencing wildfire. If the forest has sufficient resilience, it'll experience that wildfire and, you know, some trees will get burned and underbrush will get burned. But it'll essentially bounce back and become and be the same kind of system it was before. If it was a forest of predominantly maple and beech trees, a maple beech forest ecosystem, it'll come back as a maple and beech forest ecosystem if it has that resilience, and also if the disturbance wasn't too great. If the system has low resilience, for example, if it had, you know, just experienced a really bad bug infestation, or if, you know, climate had been changing and it hasn't been getting enough water and it's especially dry, then the disturbance could be so great that it actually transforms into something different. Maybe it doesn't come back as a maple beach ecosystem. Maybe it comes back as a grassland. Or you can think about this in terms of a human system. You know, if there's maybe, you know, a tornado, kind of another classic example, a tornado rips through town. Well, if it's not too destructive and if there's sufficient resilience, you know, the town kind of comes back and people keep going the way that they had been. But if it's especially destructive or if there's low resilience, then maybe the town never recovers and it becomes a different kind of town. Transformability, then, is this idea that, well, we can kind of plant different kinds of seeds for when, and again, metaphorical seeds, if you want to think of it that way, for when a disturbance does happen, that new things can be ready to take their place, and the system itself can transform overall. It's all described in the book.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith. My guest is Daniel Lurch from the Post-Carbon Institute. He's the editor of the Community Resilience Reader, and that's what we're talking about. You know, you brought out the very important fact that we have to take into account our mental state and abilities when we're looking at these things. And there's a new book out saying Donald Trump is mentally ill, but I think our whole society is mentally ill. We burn fossil fuels. We do all these things that wipe out species and wreck the planet. How can we build resilience within what we could call a massive social illness?
Boy, you've got big questions.
I do.
Well, that's why you're a successful radio host. No, but these are excellent questions. And that is a tough one. How do we build resilience within as a society? You know, I think the first thing that comes to mind for that is actually education. And we happen to have a chapter on education in the Community Resilience Reader. Partly for that very reason, that to get back to mental models, as you mentioned, if we're not understanding our own behavior as a society and our own behavior as individuals, we don't understand why we are creating the kind of destruction that we create, why we are extracting the kind of non-renewable resources that we're extracting and getting ourselves dependent on this thing. If we don't understand the why behind that, then we're never going to be able to get beyond it. And a lot of that does come down to education. And so I'm in my 40s. When I went through the public school system, I never learned anything about, you know, why. I mean, I learned, okay, we use gasoline and coal for these things, but I never learned why. You never learn, you know, someone made a decision at some point, or rather these things were discovered, and we just kind of proceeded to use them without thinking about the future very much. And one example of something that would be very useful for students of any age, but I think particularly in teenagers and college, is to understand, well, what are the things that were not questioned when we were making these early decisions about how to run modern industrial society? You know, why did we go for centuries burning wood and then burning coal? And God, Lord, wood. I mean, we created so much destruction just burning wood, entire forests around the world leveled. How is it that very few people ever thought about, you know, whether that's sustainable or not, and what's the history behind how that thinking started to change? And just a couple of weeks ago, actually, I finished a very interesting biography on the Prussian, I don't want to call him a geographer because he was really a Renaissance man, but the Prussian scientist Alexander von Humboldt. It's called The Mention of Nature. And Humboldt was one of those early, I would say even original thinker back in the late 1700s, early 1800s. He was trying to understand how does nature all fit together? How do the microscopic and the macroscopic pieces all relate? You know, people, we essentially really didn't think about that sort of thing before. The biography talks about how he traveled through South America and he kind of witnessed how people, the European colonists, grazing their animals on these what used to be virgin lands and what is now Venezuela had caused incredible environmental destruction and simply weren't thinking about it. It was just, you know, that's just the way it is. It's just how nature works. Well, it was kind of the thinking back then. So he started to try to dig into that and understand, well, how is it that we can make all these decisions, these short-term decisions, these local decisions, and they end up having regional and even global implications? It's kind of crazy to me that in the 21st century, we have a lot of people around the world who also really do not think about that. Right? That maybe they have a vague sense that, yeah, if I drive a car, if I burn this piece of wood, it's going to have some effect, but I don't really understand how or the significance. So there's basic scientific literacy that needs to happen for that. To me, the connection to resilience there is that resilience helps us understand that a system, any system, as I mentioned before, can be resilient and can persist for a long period of time. But resilient science tells us that there comes a certain point where maybe the resilience is challenged, is pushed so far that we hit a tipping point And then everything starts to change. And that tipping point itself is often unpredictable. You know, I could go for hours on this, but I think that itself is a really important thing for people to understand. Like, probably everyone listening to this show understands that, say, take climate change. We all kind of understand that we might hit a tipping point with atmospheric carbon concentrations beyond which we start getting runaway climate change. That's not necessarily a widely known fact. So, you know, things like that, again, in that mental toolkit, and that societal toolkit, I think, are really important. If everyone understood these things, or at least understood more how the world worked, how these systems work, I think we might have certainly different cultural and hopefully different political outcomes as well.
Well, we are starting to run out of time, but I wanted to ask you, are there case studies showing that community resilience works?
There are case studies at the rural level, and that's essentially where resilience science came from. And when I say the rural level, I'm talking about, you know, imagine a farming community that's dependent upon, you know, a certain area of farmland and the watershed surrounding it. Or, say, a fishing community that's dependent upon the fishery out in the ocean. They're dependent on that for their livelihood. So I think it was about 30 or maybe even 40 years ago, ecologists started to study these communities. And I call them rural, but maybe they're better thought of it as natural resource dependent communities. I mean, we're all dependent on natural resources, of course, but, you know, there's rural communities often depend on one particular resource for their livelihood. So these scientists were trying to understand, you know, how do the decisions, how does this, the system of humans on one side and the system of the ecology on the other side, how do those two interact? How do they actually function as a joint system, or what they call a social-ecological system? So it was by studying these places, studying how decisions would affect the ecosystem, how ecosystem responses would then affect human decisions, that they started to develop this model of resilience science. There's now decades of research and literature now that kind of shows how if we can change how we process information, how we make decisions in these human communities so that we do build the resilience of that overall social ecological system. So if, for example, the community chooses not to graze all the land that's available with no end in sight, instead, maybe they choose to develop some sort of decision-making process where all the stakeholders have a say in which lands get grazed and by whom and which lands will be allowed to recuperate and lay fallow. I mean, a lot of this kind of comes down to political decisions at the end of the day. It's quite interesting. So the models exist in the rural area. They don't quite exist yet in the urban area. And that's partly why we did this book, because we really wanted to promote this idea that we can take what has been learned in these rural communities and in the science overall and start to apply it to urban settings. Urban settings are much, much more complex. You've got many, many more people. You've got many different layers of modern industrial society, the economy and industry, of culture, especially in multicultural communities. There's a ton more going on, and the work on that has really just started, I'd say, in the last 5 to 10 years. But certainly the indications, I think, are that there's a lot to learn from resilience science, and there's a lot that's applicable even to modern industrial society.
Well, listeners, we don't need the nightly news to know some tough punches are coming, and we do need to be able to bounce back somehow. Island Press has just published the Community Resilience Reader, Essential Resources for an Era of Upheaval. You can search for that title or find a link to the book webpage in my show blog at ecoshock.org. And of course, you should explore postcarbon.org. Our guest has been the editor of the new Resilience Reader, Daniel Lurch. Thank you so much, Daniel.
Thank you, Alex. It was a pleasure to be here again.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We're out of time. Please join me again next week for more Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
I think that asserting your identity through your work and telling your own stories is the most important thing you can do for yourself.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Today, we're thrilled to present this in-depth conversation about art, identity, politics, and expression between graphic novelist Yasmin Omar Atta and the Electronic Intifada's contributor, Marguerite Dubai. Read Dubai's recent review of Atta's book, Mishadra, on electronicintifada.net, titled Visualizing a Feeling. And now, here's Marguerite Dubai interviewing Yasmin Omar Atta.
Who do you think is the intended audience for Being? Like, is it is the best scenario people who know nothing about what's happening in Palestine, or is it people who have some general information about what's going on?
It's really, honestly, anybody who's interested in playing. I designed the game so there's actually not a whole lot of what people would consider quote-unquote gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really, the gameplay is focused around anybody can play.
Okay.
Somebody who has never played a game can pick up this game. All that you need to press are the directional buttons and the A button, and that's it.
Okay.
So I designed it around that so it would be accessible. Anybody who is interested, even in the slightest bit, of Palestinian lived experience, that game, like, that's the intended audience. And if someone has no idea about the timeline or the facts or anything, and they play this game and they're interested, I'm like, go look it up. You know, you have Google or whatever.
Right,
like
right.
You have, or even as a library, you have some ability to find out the facts without me having to spell them out to you, because that's not my job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that person can still come to the game and be like, oh, you know, you have like the emotional information someone's giving you. And if that's enough for you to go and look up the like physical facts, then that's great. Like,
mm-hmm.
I'm glad that you're taking that away from it. at the same time, I do want people who have some information or even some bias against Palestine to play this game and see what they get from it and try to basically insert them into this experience.
Right.
And try to make that come across. And ultimately, the people who are Palestinian and have played it and, you know, really feel something for it, like when you're telling me, like, oh, it was harrowing and I loved it, that is a huge deal to me, too. So basically everybody, in so many words, like anybody who has any sort of interest in Palestinian lived experience. I'm like, please, if you want to play this game, please play this game. And for me, I always want to know what people got from it.
Okay.
You know, so anybody, really.
Okay, that's great. Okay, cool. I actually, and this kind of dovetails into another question I had, you know, keeping in mind, you know, being in Nishadra as well. So a lot of your work focuses on people living outside of conventions and challenges readers to think beyond social, cultural, and health norms. Can you talk a little about the inherent politics behind the act of existing?
It's funny because politics is an interesting word. How do I put this? It's funny because we're talking about Palestine and like, the word politics is so loaded. I'm always thinking about like the word politics includes so much.
Right.
I guess I don't know what it's like to experience what people like call quote unquote a normative life, at least here in the West. Like I've always had an identity that is looked down upon or like discriminated against even before like I understood parts of it. And now that I've like kind of, you know, I've come to fully understand my identity, it's still so intersectional that I'm constantly working in that place mm-hmm. where I'm like discriminated against multiple levels.
Right.
Like, you know, I'm Palestinian, I'm Muslim, I'm non-binary, I'm queer, like I'm disabled, like all that kind of stuff. And so sometimes it just feels like, for me, that intersectionality, like, I don't, when I define it for myself, I'm like, okay, like, that's just who I am. When you take it into a context with other people and there's politics and the social politics of that, it sometimes it just feels so heavy.
Right.
It feels really heavy to kind of have all those things. It feels, like, stacked sometimes.
Yeah.
And having to sort of fight your way into, like, getting gigs and like having people treat you with respect, which like you shouldn't have to, you know, try to get people to do. But even on stuff that I work on, like sometimes there are times where I just feel like really tokenized or mm-hmm. like we're going to point to you and you're going to be like, you know, our person who is like Palestinian and this and that and has like X amount of check marks in the diversity chart, you know?
Right.
But like at the same time, it, even though it's hard to find people who don't make you feel that way, and it can be really difficult, and, I mean, there have been times where I've been flat broke because of that kind of thing, but when you find those people, it's really rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually very, it's very, very complicated to think about what your place is in society, if you even have one. when you have, like, a non-normative, again, quote-unquote, identity. So it's interesting, too, because in that way, I've kind of been, I wouldn't say forced, but I've been more inspired to be in this place where, like, I am creating my own art, and I'm, like, in control of, like, my career and, like, my space and, like, the culture around me, et cetera, et cetera. So that's why a lot of my work is very me, and, like, there's so much of myself in everything that I do, because if I don't do it, who's gonna, like, do it for me?
Mm-hmm.
And if they do it for me, it's gonna suck.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, because they're probably gonna hire somebody who isn't, you know, own voices, isn't there telling their own story, and then I'm just gonna be mad.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Like, I've been put in this place where I assert my identity very strongly through my art, and I'm also, like, more ready to just do it myself, like the game and everything like that. I'm like, I'm gonna make this game, I'm gonna make it in 2 weeks for the show for Art Palestine, which you were in also, and it was amazing.
Yeah.
So,
it was.
Yeah, it's
I was gonna ask you about that, so, you know, feel free to, if you'd like to describe Art Palestine.
Sure. So, real quick, Art Palestine was a show that, I curated along with Art Palestine International, at Baby Castles Gallery in New York. In the spring of 2017, that's this year, and we had all kinds of art. We had paintings, we had games, we had videos, we had Margo's comics and everything on the walls of the gallery in order to kind of bring the Palestinian experience to people, and they can walk into this room and see all parts of the spectrum and get a feeling for like what it's like to be Palestinian. And like the game is in that spirit. The game that I made is trying to do the same thing, and that was in the show. And kind of going off of what I was saying earlier, you know, sometimes it's really difficult to put yourself out there and to have, and to assert your identity so strongly through your art. But at the same time, you know, there are so many times where I'm like, people don't care about Palestine. People do not care. It's not trendy enough. It's not like what people want to care and talk about. But the opening night, I walked in the room and the room is just like full of people who came out to see this. And that means they have some interest in like, are really appreciating the art, really appreciating your comics, really appreciating like the games. And to me, like that moment meant so much because it's like, sometimes it's hard and sometimes it feels like, you know, sometimes you're just like, it's not worth it. It's so difficult, but people do care. You just have to put yourself out there and like, you really have to focus on being like, this is who I am. Yeah. And like, I'm not apologizing for it.
Yeah.
If anything, I'm going to like bolster myself and the people around me and really just exist, whether someone likes it or not, you know? And if they don't like it, like, it's not my problem.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and so like, you know, things get violent, et cetera, but like, and you just have to assert your identity, and what that means for different people is it. Everyone's different, and everyone has a different idea of what that means. But like, we exist. That's the title of the game. Is just being.
Yeah.
Which makes it really hard to name search, honestly. But like, it's supposed to be simple because it's like we are being, we are existing, and whether or not the politics of existing likes it or not. Like, mm-hmm. you know, people can exist whether you want them mm-hmm. to. You know? So, it's a very complicated question, a complicated answer, but I think that asserting your identity through your work and telling your own stories is the most important thing you can do for yourself. That was like, someone asked me recently, like, what advice do you have for, you know, artists who are starting out? I'm like, don't be afraid. That was a lot. I hope that makes sense.
No, that makes total sense.
Okay, good.
And I very much appreciate it. I think it's good. Great. So
I'm glad. It's again, like, sometimes it's really hard, and sometimes like with Mr. Adra, I made the first part of the comic and I put it online, and I was like, I was about to hit the like the tweet or like the post button, and I was like, no one's gonna care about this. I was like, no one's gonna read this. Like, what am I even doing? Why am I putting this out there so hard? Like, I'm kind of scared, and I just kind of closed my eyes and just went, boop, and did it anyway. But, like, that was 4 years ago, and it's completely, like, A, taught me how to be decent at comics.
Yeah.
B, taught me how to be more open about my identity. C, gave me chops, because I had to draw that comic a lot.
Yeah.
And D, it's guided my career. Like, at this point, having a big publisher pick it up and be like, we want this, and we want a platform for the world, and like, I was also scared, kind of, to go into AAA or whatever big name publishing. Triple A's games, right? You
know?
Big publishers.
Yeah, yeah.
I was kind of, a little nervous because, like, you know, gender, et cetera, whatever. But I just got incredibly lucky, and, like, my publisher and everyone involved in the project has been, like, really nice, really open, Great. Super supportive. And so because I took that chance and I just threw it out there and, like, just was really open about my experience and not apologetic about it. Like, now I'm just being blessed with, like, a really good opportunity. So.
That's fantastic.
Just do it. Yeah. Don't be afraid.
So I am going to ask, because this is a question I love asking every single artist I talk to ever. So what are your artistic inspirations?
Yes. You can't see I'm folding my hands right now. So when I was in school, my amazing and beautiful teacher, Keith Marison, bless him.
Yes.
When I first got into class, like one of my first years, he was like, okay, everybody, I don't care, just read Osamu Tezuka. Just do it. Read Tezuka, read Tezuka, read Tezuka. Every time. And mm-hmm. I was like, okay, I guess I have to read Tezuka. Mm-hmm. And, you know, most people know Astro Boy and all of that.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I knew. And so I went to the library, and I checked out, like, 4 volumes of Blackjack, and I was just like, oh my god!
Well, Blackjack is amazing, so.
It's my favorite series of all time.
Yeah.
And I was that jerk who had all 17 volumes of Blackjack out at the same time. I'm so sorry if anybody around 2011 was trying to read it at the SBA library. I apologize. But so instantly it just clicked with me. And so Osamu Tezuka, even though I kind of discovered him a little bit, you know, further into my life and a little bit more recently, he's my ultimate influence. And I think if you read Mishandra, that it kind of comes through, because the reason why Keith Marison's asking us to read him, multiple reasons, but one of them was what he called synesthetic visuals. Mm-hmm. And that idea that you should be using your panels, using your spaces, using your speech bubbles, using everything you have at your disposal, and like you're essentially your visual toolbox to help things come across, as opposed to just saying, I'm upset, and things like that. That's so important, and that will help what he would call, like, suture in. Mm-hmm. But people really feel viscerally what's going on, and that, I really brought that to Mishandra, and so Tezuka will always be, like, that's where I learned it from. I learned it from the best.
Okay.
So, that's the biggest one. I have a lot of influence through, like, I grew up on, like, the, like, FLCL manga, I'm a huge Hajime Ueda fan, and I think that also you probably see that. I really love Yoshitaka Amano.
Oh, yes.
I love old Final Fantasy drawings, and I don't know if that really comes through or not, but I always look at those and I'm just like, this is next level. So that's more of an inspiration of like, wow, I really have to keep drawing.
Yeah.
And like, kind of a sort of a thing to like break out of your box. It's so different from what I draw, so I look at it and I'm like, you know, what can I experiment with or whatever. So those artistically are my influences. As far as inspiration goes, I'm always inspired. I have 2 friends, Chris McKay and Sloan Young, and they're always making amazing work, and I'm always really inspired by, like, their art and also their friendship.
So. Okay.
Yeah, no, I'm just like,
aww.
Friends and good art is like what I live for.
Well, I mean I'm constantly pushed by my friends to mm-hmm. make better work, so
yeah,
that's entirely understandable.
Totally,
yeah.
I think that's so important, because I've heard people be like, oh, I try not to be influenced by everybody. And I'm like, really? That sounds like a bad idea. And like, a lot of people don't really engage with their friends' work or their comics or whatever. And I'm like, you're really doing yourself a disservice at that point. It's like so valuable to read someone's work and like possibly like get to know them and befriend them
mm-hmm.
and build positive energy around yourself. And also like start to look at things that help you break out of your box. It's so important. And it's like so rewarding, and like, you know, it's so positive that you really should be engaging with people's work and then, like, befriending people and, like, hanging out with people who have a similar vibe or, like your work as well, and you can build, like, a positive, like, niche community that
mm-hmm.
way that will support you. So
mm-hmm.
that is really important to me, very. So, yeah, that's, I really like to just get hyped about my friends' work. So, and that's part of why like doing the Our Palestine show was so great. Because I was like, oh, I'm gonna get Cargo and see if she wants to do it.
Yeah.
I'm gonna ask our friend Layla Abdel Razak if she wants to do it. And so we had like a really positive thing going on. And it's like, yes, like the Palestinians and comics, like you know, let's work together, let's support each other, that kind of thing.
Yeah. No, it was fantastic. So thank you. You know, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah,
that's fun and cool. And I'm really hyped to be doing this for Electronic Intifada, because I'm doing a thumbs up right now.
They are indeed thumbs upping, so there you go. So.
No, it's good. I'm hyped, and thank you for having me and doing this.
No, thank you very much, and, you know, good luck with the release of Mishandra again. Please look for it when it comes out.
That was Marguerite Dubai interviewing graphic novelist Yasmin Omar Atta. Thanks to Sharif Zakut, our music maker and production assistant. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, support the Electronic Intifada by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jamal Abdi with the National Iranian American Council, who warns that President Trump's decertification of the International Nuclear Agreement with Iran will isolate and undermine U.S. credibility around the world. Egan Kemp of Public Citizen, who examines the impact of President Trump's recent executive orders on the cost and coverage of health care insurance for millions of Americans. And Lori Sobel, the Kaiser Family Foundation, who discusses how the Trump administration issued new rules that give employers the right to deny their female employees access to birth control insurance coverage. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The government of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is waging an active campaign to discredit a new global estimate of modern slavery developed by the International Labour Organization, the International Organization for Migration, and the Australia-based Walk Free Foundation. The recently published reports estimate that 40 million people across the globe are victims of forced labour, forced marriage, and human trafficking. The research found that over 60% of the victims of slavery live in the Asia-Pacific region. India's Intelligence Bureau drafted a secret memo to the Prime Minister stating that these reports target India as home to the highest number of slaves in the world. The memo warns that the estimate could substantially harm India's image, exports, and damage the nation's ability to meet the United Nations Sustainable Development Goal of eradicating forced and child labor and human trafficking. Of particular concern was a potential backlash against South Asia's textile industry, which is affected by laws in the United States and United Kingdom requiring garment suppliers to demonstrate they do not employ forced labor. A series of reports by European activist groups raised concern about widespread slavery, including the use of child labor in producing India's textiles for export to Western corporations. Under intense pressure to end Chicago's epidemic of violence, politicians and federal law enforcement agencies waged a campaign in 2014 against street-level gun dealers. The drive used paid informants who set up gun deals that entrapped numerous inner-city residents for selling guns. According to ProPublica, most of the guns seized in Chicago come from Indiana and other nearby states, which have weaker gun laws. Most of the guns police seize were initially legally purchased, after which they were sold, loaned, or stolen, ending up in Chicago's firearms black market. Most illegal gun sales in the Windy City are brokered by individuals or small groups, not organized by large trafficking syndicates. Under pressure to respond to the violence, law enforcement has focused on making examples of people caught selling, buying, or possessing guns. But authorities acknowledge that these cases do little to stem the flow of guns into the city. An in-depth examination of one case showed how authorities targeted mostly street-level offenders, sometimes enticing them with outsized payoffs. Leading critics say their techniques raise questions of whether they are dismantling gun networks or effectively helping to set them up. Amid the fury of recent hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria, Louisiana has made substantial investments in coastal land protection. This includes developing a new coastal floodgate system of levees and locks to protect Terrebonne Parish from storm surges. It's one of the costliest infrastructure projects made without the aid of U.S. government funding. Currently, Louisiana loses a football field's worth of land every hour due to a combination of factors including rising sea levels, sinking land, levee building, and drilling for oil and gas that have disrupted the Mississippi River Delta's natural marshland building processes. The loss of land leaves coastal communities exposed to damaging storm surges, which are expected to increase with climate change. Hurricane Harvey, which deluged Greater Houston, cost over $190 billion in damages, equal to the combined cost of the destruction caused by Hurricane Katrina and Superstorm Sandy. Some observers say Louisiana shouldn't have to tackle such an immense challenge on its own,
particularly given the likelihood that other states will soon be facing similar hurdles. According to critics, the limited role the federal government has played thus far in Louisiana is inexcusable. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
President Donald Trump announced on October 13th that he's formally decertifying the international nuclear agreement with Iran. While Mr. Trump has stated that, quote, the Iran deal was one of the worst and most one-sided transactions the United States ever entered into, unquote, he declined to terminate the Iran agreement. Instead, he moved the issue to Congress, where legislators will engage in a 60-day period of debate on whether or not to reimpose economic sanctions against Iran that had been in effect before the nuclear deal was signed in 2015. Reimposition of the sanctions will effectively withdraw the U.S. from the nuclear agreement. While Trump has repeatedly stated that Iran has violated the spirit of the agreement, the U.N.'s International Atomic Energy Agency says that Iran is in compliance. The other signatories to the deal, Russia, China, France, Britain, and Germany, all have maintained their support for the deal, just as Trump's own defense secretary, secretary of state, and the Pentagon's chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff have publicly expressed support for the agreement. Your reporter spoke with Jamal Abdi, policy director with the National Iranian American Council, who assesses the fallout from Trump's decision to decertify the Iran nuclear deal and warns that a move to withdraw the U.S. from the agreement will both isolate and undermine U.S. credibility around the world.
By decertifying, it doesn't do anything on its own. But what it does is it kicks off a 60-day period in Congress where there are expedited rules to introduce sanctions legislation to snap back the sanctions that were eased under the nuclear deal. Now, that 60-day window is now open. And what it means is that if the majority or minority leaders in either the House or the Senate, if they introduce legislation that specifically snaps back the nuclear sanctions, no other sanctions, only the sanctions that were lifted under the deal, that legislation is guaranteed to get a vote. It can't be stopped in committee. It goes to the floor in the chamber it's introduced in. It gets a vote. It gets passed to the other chamber. And the key is that in the Senate, there is no filibuster. It is a straight majority, simple majority vote. So unlike when the deal actually got through Congress and you had, every single Republican voting against it, but they had to hit that 60-vote threshold, now we've got this simple majority. And so this is sort of a conundrum that this Congress has had under Trump, this Republican Congress, this responsibility of governing. And so really nobody in Congress, even those people who oppose the deal, they don't actually want to kill the thing. They just want to rack up these political points and say how much they hate it. But what Donald Trump has effectively done, unwittingly, is kind of called their bluff. And now it's up to either, Kevin McCarthy in the House or Mitch McConnell in the Senate. If they introduce that snapback legislation, it's going to get a vote. Either enough Republicans are going to have to vote to protect the deal, or they vote against it, the sanctions snap back, and the U.S. is then in violation of the deal. That means the U.S. basically exits the deal. And then we find out, okay, can the deal be salvaged by just, Europe, China, Russia, and Iran? Or does Iran end up wanting to back out of elements of the deal? And it's sort of a nightmare. Nobody really knows how that process plays out.
What's the likely response in Iran to this ongoing process in the United States that jeopardizes this nuclear agreement, especially from the hardline factions within the Tehran government?
For the hardliners, this is an I told you so moment. The supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, who has, final say over these things, what the supreme leader said was, okay, you can go ahead with these negotiations. That's fine. But at the end of the day, you can't trust the United States. even if we deal with the nuclear issue, they're just going to pivot and say there's some other reason that they're our enemy. And so this is a futile exercise, but you go ahead with it. I'm not going to stop you. And now they're really saying, I told you so. But I think inside of Iran, the challenge here is it sort of empowers the hardliners, and it sort of forces, you know, Rouhani and the moderates. They've actually had to sort of – Rouhani actually challenged the IRGC and the hardline, you know, military wing in Iran, challenged them in his election, which is unprecedented. And now, after what Trump did, he's actually having to stand up for the IRGC. And so you sort of see this homogenization of the politics in Iran because of Trump's move.
One last quick question. If either Congress – or Donald Trump abrogate this international nuclear agreement with Iran, what are the consequences for U.S. credibility in the world? And I'm thinking about, you know, any hope there might be for some kind of nuclear control agreement with North Korea. It's hard to understand how a country would approach the United States with Donald Trump in the White House to sign on to such an agreement.
Yeah, and I think that we're sort of talking about pulling out the thread of all of our diplomatic tools here. I mean, I think some of the damage has already been done. Now there's sort of a question of, well, we deal with one president, and then the next president, who knows who's going to be elected? And they apparently don't feel that they are beholden to the agreements that the country signed previously. So I think that, especially when we look at North Korea, where, you know, this is going to be a huge diplomatic undertaking if we're going to be able to solve that challenge. Peacefully. And all this has done is just sapped our credibility and sapped our leverage to be able to ask for anything now that we're not a trustworthy actor. So I think it's extremely damaging to diplomacy. And it sort of puts the U.S. in the position of the only, tool that you can actually, view as credible is military force. And that's a really dark prospect, I think, going forward, not just for this presidency, but for administrations to come potentially.
That was Jamal Abdi, policy director with the National Iranian American Council. Find links to more news and commentary about the Iran nuclear agreement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After several major attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare, President Trump issued two executive orders on October 12th with the stated goal of dismantling his predecessor's landmark health care legislative achievement. The first executive order asked the Labor Department to loosen rules that permit small companies to form associations and buy the kind of coverage available to larger businesses. These plans would have lower standards and cover far fewer health care costs. The second executive order ends $9 billion in subsidies paid under the Obamacare program to reduce the cost of health insurance for low-income Americans. Ironically, nearly 70% of those benefiting from subsidies cut by the president live in states Trump won in the 2016 presidential election. Taken together, Trump's two executive orders will result in an increase in the number of Americans without health insurance, the erosion of health insurance standards, substantial increases in insurance premiums, market instability, and increased expenses for the federal government. The day after the executive orders were issued, 18 U.S. states sued the president to stop him from ending the payment of Obamacare subsidies. Meanwhile, Republican Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee and Democratic Senator Patty Murray of Washington State agreed in principle on a bill that would cover the subsidy payments for 2 years. But the fate of that legislation is uncertain at best. Your reporter spoke with Egan Kemp, healthcare policy advocate with Public Citizen and a former senior policy analyst at the U.S. Government Accountability Office. Here he examines the impact of President Trump's recent executive orders on the U.S. healthcare system.
Millions of Americans will experience either higher premiums, or they may, be scared away from getting coverages because there's going to be some sticker shock, even if their premiums might cover the cost, some of the cost changes.
Do we have an estimate of how many people could lose their health insurance over the course of the next year once these, specifically the subsidies, disappear?
We don't have an exact estimate, but there are some. There's the potential of millions of folks losing their coverage. The other thing that Trump had said that he was hoping that this would do was to save money, but that we also know that's not the case based on estimates from the Congressional Budget Office, that ultimately, even though they're cutting these subsidies, it'll cost the federal government nearly $200 billion over the next decade because the insurance companies are now going to need to charge higher premiums. But because of the way the law is structured, most folks, those increases will be covered by the federal government. So it's there will be, you know, around 1.5 to 2 million folks that are going to see, you know, direct increases that won't be covered by the subsidies that they're getting.
Now, how about the association health plans? What kind of impact does the Trump executive order on the association health plans have on the overall insurance market?
Yeah, that one's pretty significant as well. And you know, the implications there could be far-ranging. So this particular executive order, it directs certain parts of the federal government to make new rules or regulations. And what's scaring people is that the way that it could be written, it could allow companies to sell across state lines. And so, you know, something that we experienced before the Affordable Care Act was a race to the bottom in terms of insurance standards. So there was companies offering junk plans that could be sold across state lines, and that's sort of the fear that it could go back to that. So things that weren't that often weren't covered previously were maternity care or mental health services or severe limitations on prescription drugs. And the real fear is that folks could be end up thinking that they're paying less, but what they're paying for is a junk plan that won't cover them when they get sick.
What are the wider societal ripple effects from having these plans that don't really cover what they cover currently because of the ACA standards?
One of the benefits of the Affordable Care Act is a reduction in the amount of debt Americans are taking on due to medical expenses. Folks are able to get coverage earlier. They're able to maintain coverage. Without the proper regulation, someone could think they're signing up for something good, and then once they get sick, realize they have to bear all that expense, which may mean taking on medical debt and may mean declaring bankruptcy.
As I've been reading about these changes, one of the warnings that has been written about by a lot of commentators and those inside the health insurance industry is a general concern about what they call destabilization of the health insurance marketplace, which means you might have more health insurance companies pulling out of the Obamacare exchanges. But the effects could go further than that, I've been reading. Tell us what your concerns are about the stability of the marketplace.
Some states, they have their insurance companies provide two sets of rate increases. And so some states, maybe they had a 10, some insurers said, you know, we expect to raise it, you know, 8 to 10%. And then if the state asked them for the second set, it might have been, you know, 20 to 30%. And that's a big difference. And all of a sudden, if you're an insurer, you're about to start opening your market and start, you know, recruiting folks. So now you're having to, you know, have these much higher premiums. So anyone looking on, you know, any sort of state exchange or federal exchange, they're seeing some really high prices, and they might, you know, step away. And if there's less folks enrolling, that means the folks that are left who may be sicker are going to be facing even higher premiums over time. And that's one of the real concerns about sort of the destabilization is that you'd have insurance companies with these junk plans cherry picking the healthy people out of the market, which are just going to leave sick folks in the actual ACA regulated plans, meaning they're going to be paying outrageous sums. And, you know, it just may not be solvent that an insurance company just can't only be insuring the sickest folks.
Egan, what do we know about public opinion on Obamacare, whether to repeal, replace this kind of direct sabotage that we see from the White House? Do we know how Americans by and large feel Congress and the White House should be moving in terms of improving the healthcare system of the country?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that we're seeing is that throughout the repeal and replace efforts, the Affordable Care Act has only gotten more popular. We're seeing, you know, the majority of Americans approving of what the Affordable Care Act does and wanting it continued, that it's a very small amount of Americans that want it, you know, repealed or repealed and replaced. Americans are realizing sort of the importance that the Affordable Care Act has meant for them. And I think that's only going to continue, especially if Americans continue to see higher premiums. And polling also indicates that, you know, Trump doesn't think he's going to get blamed for this. He's said that again and again, but the polls don't say that. The polls indicate that that Congress and Trump will be held accountable for this sabotage.
That was Egan Kemp, healthcare policy advocate with Public Citizen and a former senior policy analyst at the U.S. Government Accountability Office. For more analysis of the Trump administration's policies impacting healthcare costs and insurance coverage, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In early October, the Trump administration announced a major rollback in coverage under the Affordable Care Act, which the Republican-dominated Congress has so far failed to repeal. Under the ACA, a suite of more than a dozen birth control options were required to be made available, at no cost, for women to choose the method best for them. That element of Obamacare was immediately challenged in court, based on the argument that employers should not be forced to provide birth control if they objected based on their religious beliefs. A convoluted system was later devised to respond to those concerns, which allowed women to receive the birth control insurance coverage they needed. According to the latest regulation issued by the Trump Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Labor, the head of virtually any company can now decide that providing birth control coverage violates their religious beliefs or moral view, and deny their female employees free birth control coverage. The regulation went into effect on October 6th. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Lori Sobel, Associate Director of Women's Health Policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Here she discusses how exemptions to the birth control mandate have grown over time, how the new rules change may affect women, and how groups across the U.S. are fighting back.
So under the Obama administration, there were rules that were drafted to allow for religious employers to have an exemption, and that was limited to houses of worship for the exemption, which had the effect of the women insured by those policies would not get contraceptive coverage. And then there was a second category allowing for an accommodation, which allowed religiously affiliated nonprofits, and then after the case of Hobby Lobby, closely held for-profits to have an accommodation, which meant that the employer had to notify someone. They had to notify either their insurer or third-party administrator or the government that they had a religious objection to providing some or all contraceptive coverage, and then the insurer was obligated to provide that coverage. So the effect on the people insured by those policies was that they still had full coverage for contraceptives with no cost sharing. It shifted who paid for that coverage, but the women and employed and the dependents that were insured by those plans still had full coverage.
But the Trump administration really blew a much bigger hole in the exemptions, right?
Right. So now the exemption is expanded to everyone who previously had the accommodation. They can choose to stay with the accommodation or shift to an exemption, which again has this impact that the workers and dependents would not have the coverage anymore. So there was a group of nonprofits in particular that had been litigating the accommodation, saying it didn't go far enough to meet their needs in terms of their religious beliefs, that they felt they were complicit in providing that coverage if they had to notify someone to that would then provide that coverage. So those nonprofits that have litigated will likely opt for an exemption now. In addition, the closely held for-profits can also opt for an exemption. That group of employers has not litigated the accommodation, but we don't know to what extent they had been complying with the accommodation. There's a whole new group of employers that would now be eligible for the exemption outside of those groups. So in addition, any employer, regardless if they're nonprofit or for-profit, including publicly traded companies, that have a religious objection to providing some or all contraceptive coverage can choose to be exempt. In addition, there's a new category of employers that have a moral objection, and that's open to any employer except for publicly traded for-profits. So all nonprofits and all for-profits that are not publicly traded can opt for an exemption based upon a moral objection to some or all contraceptive coverage.
So do the employers have to provide any kind of proof of their moral or religious opposition?
There's no proof that's required.
Lori Sobel, is there any way to figure out how many women could be impacted by these changes?
We certainly have no idea how many employers would take up a moral objection. There were numbers in the regulations that were really speculative. By regulations, I mean the preamble before the regulations that the agencies wrote, that basically tried to figure out how many employers had litigated, and based upon that, how many would take the exemption versus the accommodation, and then try and figure out how many employees each of those organizations has. And the truth is we really have no idea, because this expands the categories so greatly that we don't know which employers would take this up.
So these changes have already gone into effect, but what's happening in the fight back?
There's active litigation going on already. The groups that I know about, that I'm not entirely clear if they've all filed, but they've all announced that they're going to litigate, is the National Women's Law Center, the ACLU, the Center for Reproductive Rights, the Attorney General of California, and the Attorney General of Massachusetts.
There's a silver lining for women who live in states that guarantee more coverage than the federal government, right?
There's 8 states that have their own laws that are at least as expansive as the ACA in terms of what's required, so no cost sharing for coverage of contraceptives of all 18 methods. Essentially, it's the ACA benefit required at a state level, and most of those states have a more narrowly defined exemption than is now in the federal law. So we know 61% of workers across the country that are covered workers are insured by self-insured plans, and those aren't regulated by the state. So that's where the gap will be. So if you're an employer in California that has a moral objection and you have a self-insured plan, then you're exempt from the federal law and you're not covered by the state law.
That was Lori Sobel, Associate Director of Women's Health Policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Learn more about the Trump and Republican Party's rollback of women's access to birth control by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, KTWH in Two Harbors, Minnesota, KMUD in Garberville, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
The Battles of History. The events surrounding Charlottesville, Virginia, have a resonance far beyond the borders of Old Dominion. even though they began as a strictly local affair, they quickly assumed a national character, because this strictly local event stems from the nation's history, a history that remains not only contested, but bitterly unresolved. That history, of course, is the toxic poison of white supremacy, and the trigger thereof, African slavery, the intentional, centuries-long economic, social, communal, and psychic exploitation of Africans for the financial and psychological benefits of the white nation. This toxin has tainted the bloodstream of the nation and infected all segments of society and was integral to the very development of whiteness as a core identity for millions of people who call themselves Americans. As we look at protests rolling throughout the country, the first thing we must recognize is that this isn't about monuments, nor is it about the Civil War. It is about the present. It is about how this country will define itself, how it sees itself, and how it understands its future. But history, true history, is more about today than yesterday, for it is the pathway to tomorrow, and it lives or dies in the minds of the young who learn or unlearn how this country came to be and what role they play in the days to come. That great black freedom fighter, Malcolm X, repeatedly said, "Of all our studies, history best rewards our research." He knew this not only because he was taught this by his teacher, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, but because he learned this in the very experience of his life. For as a state prisoner, a man so hated that he was called Satan, his learning of a deeper history of black people literally made him a new man. It gave him confidence. It turned his loathing into loving. It gave him purpose, and perhaps more importantly, perspective. Perspective. How to look at the world, how to interpret it, how to understand why things are the way they are. That's the real value of history. It teaches perspective of the now, not then. And that's the reason why monuments turned green by oxidation and pigeon poop are seemingly at the center of these controversies. The Trump presidency signaled a great leap backwards. It has the expression of a deep, profound fear of the future, of change, of transformation. So they hold on to yesterday, invoking tradition as if the central tradition of America wasn't and isn't black slavery, black exploitation, which launched it into an international economic power. Charlottesville is thus a turning point, a pivot point, upon which the nation turns back or moves forward, creating a new history. This only the people of America can and will decide. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Gangsters in government. In a matter of days, the White House has gone through its latest purge. Gone are stalwarts of the GOP, men like journalist Sean Spicer and former Republican National Committee chief Reince Priebus, Trump's former press secretary and chief of staff, respectively. Spicer contorted himself like a pretzel trying to please his boss, but his efforts only led to more and more humiliation. From snap hiring of a political neophyte and outsider to be his communications chief served as the unkindest cut, sending Spicer on his way. Priebus had his share of humiliation pie as the newest hire, with Trump's tacit approval, savaged him in the media. Trump needed no help in humiliating his AG, a man who left the safe seat in the Senate to grab a ride on the Trump train. At every speech in the last few days, Trump needled Attorney General Jeff Sessions, showing a mean streak made meaner by the acquisition of imperial power. Trump, who saw his repeal and replace efforts to abolish Obamacare go down in flames, has had a presidential temper tantrum, slashing and burning all whom he deems disloyal. He, like a drunken monarch, demands loyalty from all, while he grants loyalty to none. Like the empire he represents, his office is a site of palace intrigue, of upheaval, of dysfunction, of glory days gone by, never to rise again. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
My given name is Edward Sisram. My Islamic name is Omar Asghar Ali, which I'm known more by. My topic today is about a billboard set up in Pennsylvania, across the state of Pennsylvania, so that we can give additional exposure to the bill that was introduced by Jason Dawkins, House Bill 135, for the purpose of parole eligibility for life sentence prisoners in the state of Pennsylvania. Most states in America provide parole eligibility for life sentence prisoners. Pennsylvania is one of the few states without the opportunity for parole. Therefore, an escrow has been established with the Human Rights Coalition, 4135 Lancaster Avenue, Philadelphia, PA 19104, www.hrcoalition.org, for the purpose to defray the cost of $1,000 for a 10x22 billboard, which will promote additional awareness of House Bill 135, which gives life sentence prisoners an opportunity who have served 15 years parole. The billboard will be leased from clearchanneloutdoors.com. Recently, State Senator Sharif Street has introduced legislation, a companion bill to House Bill 135 introduced by State Representative Jason Dawkins. We are appealing to the court of public opinion that we would appreciate your input in helping us raise the finances that we in this endeavor to erect billboards with the information about House Bill 135 all over the state of Pennsylvania. Thank you very much.
Is it possible that the mass shootings of scores of individuals during the October 1st concert in Las Vegas could have been faked? What key inconsistencies can be found in the way injured people were rescued and treated? What do we know about the alleged shooter, Stephen Paddock, and what can we make of his brother's confusing testimonials? Who was the prime beneficiary of the Las Vegas shootings? How did the Las Vegas attack compare with other mass shootings in recent history? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we take an in-depth look at some of the anomalies and discrepancies at the heart of the official narrative of the three-week-old Las Vegas tragedy and try to make sense of what is and is not being discussed in the wake of what's been called the deadliest massacre in modern U.S. history. Our guests are independent journalist and commentator Debbie Lusignan and 21st Century Wire staff writer and researcher Sean Helton. On this week's program, the Las Vegas shooting, cracks in the official narrative. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of October 20th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. In his statement last week, Trump blamed Obama for having lifted nuclear sanctions on Iran, quote, just before what would have been the total collapse of the Iranian regime, unquote. After Netanyahu became Israeli Prime Minister in early 2009, his administration worked assiduously for 4 years to maneuver the Obama administration into giving Iran an ultimatum over its enrichment program. Obama rejected such a proposal, but Bolton has repeated his call for the United States to bomb Iran year after year. Now, the Trump administration is playing out a new chapter in the drama of the Likudists and their patrons in Washington. Their objective is nothing less than using U.S. power to weaken Iran through military means if possible and economic sanctions if necessary. That comes from the article Donald Trump's Likudist Campaign Against Iran by Gareth Porter, posted October 20th, originally appearing at The American Conservative. After Trump's October 13th announcement, the leaders of Britain, France, and Germany said in a joint statement that retaining the Iran deal, quote, is in our shared national security interest, unquote. They stated, quote, the nuclear deal was the culmination of 13 years of diplomacy and was a major step towards ensuring that Iran's nuclear program is not diverted for military purposes, unquote. Trump walks in lockstep with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has consistently opposed the Iran deal. The Christian Zionists who await Christ's second coming in Israel constitute a significant portion of Trump's base. That comes from the article, Trump and Netanyahu Walk in Lockstep on Iran, by Marjorie Cohn, posted October 20th. Washington, Israel, and its sinister AIPAC lobby resent Iranian sovereign independence, its military strength solely for defense, an obstacle to Israeli regional dominance along with America's presence. Were Haley's hostile Wednesday remarks prelude for initiating diabolical Trump administration plans ahead, including naked aggression against the country, nuclear deal decertification, a starter for what's to come? Haley called for tough Security Council action against Iran not forthcoming. Washington ignores international law, acting unilaterally or with rogue allies, pursuing its ruthless imperial agenda. Does it include war on North Korea and Iran? That comes from the article, Neocon, Nikki Haley's Anti-Iran Rage, Prelude to War, by Stephen Ledman, posted October 20th. It is always possible that President Trump could destroy the U.S.-Iran agreement on an impulse and even, much more serious, pick a quarrel with the Revolutionary Guards. But it is more probable that he will once again act up in order to soothe his Israeli and Saudi allies. We have to keep in mind that Donald Trump is not a professional politician, but a real estate promoter, and that he acts like one. He gained his professional success by spreading panic with his outrageous statements and observing the reactions he had created amongst his competitors and his partners. In order to decide between these two hypotheses, we will have to wait for sanctions against the Revolutionary Guard. Then we shall see whether or not they are serious or simply an expression of Donald Trump's manner and the traditional masquerade of the United States against Iran. That comes from the article, Should U.S. Policy Against Iran Be Taken Seriously? By Thierry Maissan, translated by Pete Kimberly, posted October 20th, originally appearing at VoltaireNet.org. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. On the evening of October 1st, 2017, a single gunman, 64-year-old Stephen Paddock, from his 32nd-floor room at the Mandalay Bay Hotel, supposedly fired multiple rounds of ammunition at attendees of the Route 91 Harvest Music Festival half a kilometer away, managing to kill 58 and injure hundreds. A number of skeptical accounts have begun to surface on the internet and some independent media discrediting this narrative. One such account was from Debbie Lusignan. I interviewed her recently about her investigation. Debbie Lusignan is an activist and commentator on social media who goes by the handle Sane Progressive. She regularly puts out video essays in which she expertly deconstructs many of the false media narratives that surround contemporary political discourse. In recent weeks, she's devoted significant resources exploring the Las Vegas mass shooting, and has come across some interesting findings that I believe our listening audience needs to confront, especially if they've been enraptured by the mainstream and social media reporting on the incident. So here she is joining us from her home in Adams, Massachusetts. Hello, Debbie, and thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Michael. What a lovely introduction, and it is a pleasure, as always, to be speaking with you.
I guess I just wanted to start, first of all, I know that there's a specific aspect that you've chosen to focus on, and that having to do with some of the just basically a lot of the victim narratives and this just the depiction of the sheer magnitude of the devastation and the tragedy that's being presented, as opposed to some of the more commonplace narratives around, multiple shooters and, some of the background of the alleged assassin. So I'm just wondering if you might want to explain how you came to that specific focus, as opposed to the more kind of forensic type questions that I mentioned, which you seem to see as something of a distraction.
Yes, gotcha. Well, I guess I should tell you how I started to look at this story. When I first started to look at the footage coming out of Vegas, both the amateur footage coming from the crowd and what they were showing on the mainstream media, I noticed that what they were saying, the official narrative, that 60 people, well, 59 people and 60 with the alleged shooter committing suicide, 60 people murdered and near 600 people shot with an automatic rifle or machine gun weapon. And I looked at the footage and I was looking at clip after clip after clip after clip. And I'm like, I'm not seeing what they're saying I'm seeing. I'm just not seeing it. Maybe I'm missing something. Maybe there's footage I haven't seen, but I'm not seeing it. And immediately that just put my radar up. You'd see things like people falling over, you'd see blood, you know, after people were hit, you'd hear for cries for help, you'd hear cries for ambulances, just nothing was there. So I went forward and basically reviewed every bit of amateur footage I could find, mainstream media footage I can find, even the leaked stage footage, or what I very, very much believe to be stage footage. And there is no evidence, public evidence, if you actually examine it, that matches the official narrative. So I started to go, and I was following that angle. Then I started to look at the rescues, which was another thing that made no sense to me. What we saw was not rescues by ambulance, medevac helicopter, fire trucks, firefighters, police officers. What you did see, such as a clip that I include in one of the videos over on my BitChute channel, is you see rescues by stolen pickup trucks or commandeered pickup trucks in scenes with victims being rescued in wheelbarrows and even clothing apparel carts and just making no sense. And if you look at those, if you look at the footage of this rescue, there is no blood. There's no blood on the ground. There's no blood on the victims. There's no blood on the rescuers. There's no blood. And so I followed through to look into the story of the pickup truck rescues. What I found, what I've come to believe is that this was not only, what the story around the shooter was fake, and the story around Paddock and Jesus Campos and all of the newly added witnesses of Stephen Schmuck. The real story is that this was a staged event. It didn't happen.
Maybe we could just drill down just on a couple of the examples. I mean, yes, there's just an avalanche of video testimony and eyewitness testimony. Interestingly enough, you said there's no blood, and yet you have so many of these eyewitnesses saying, "Oh, there is blood everywhere," and then talking about it being a war zone.
We're looking at what they're showing us.
The videos of alleged eyewitnesses, I guess.
I challenge anybody. Now, I have done a video over on BitChute, which I encourage people to watch, because you really need to review this and see this with your own eyes. Because what you have is the media telling you you're seeing something that you actually never see. You don't see it. Mm-hmm. So if you go over to my video on BitChute, I will give you the footage. I can't, not every bit, but I give you many links of the footage that was taken from the crowd of the people who were there. And you have people, and they are scanning the crowd with their cameras, and they're saying things like, "I don't see anybody actually injured. Those aren't real gunshots. You don't see people lying on the field. You don't see any blood. You don't see any shell casings. You just don't see it. What you do see is there is a video of people starting to run and file out before the gunshots started to be heard in the crowd. They Don't Know song goes with Jason Aldean, I show you the video clip of that. Now, people have pointed out to me, they say, "Well, it's dark." I was like, okay, but you still don't see any of it in the video, but it is a little dark. You don't see people lying on the field. You also will notice when you listen, after the boom, and you hear the shots, you don't hear screams, cries of agony, cries for help. You hear silence. For the first initial fire, you hear silence, and then you hear silence. And then when the crowd figures out something's going on, then you hear a little bit of like, "Oh, run, run." But nobody hit, nobody falling over. And then if that's really not enough, and that really should be enough to get people's radar up. Then you look at the rescue scenes with no blood and no firefighters and no ambulances and no medevac helicopters. But what you do see is rescue by wheelbarrow and pickup truck. And, you know, and they're giving contradicting narratives, because there's a story in the Chicago Tribune where they're literally saying that the firefighters, police, and medics were storming the field while the guns still fell, and police were forming this protective bubble, and they ran in and to get the victims while the bullets still fell. Of course, there's not an inch of footage of that. But everybody is rescued by pickup truck. Now,
They can get the pickup trucks in, but they can't get the ambulances in. I don't quite understand that.
Well, you want to hear a narrative that is just like, if you think that, I want you to hear the narrative of Taylor Winston.
Yes.
Taylor Winston is the lead pickup truck rescuer. Now, Taylor Winston allegedly stole a pickup truck from an adjoining parking lot, or it was lying around on the ground, because the stories are always inconsistent, but there's two versions of it. But in either case, the keys just happened to be lying in it, and Taylor Winston allegedly put 15 critically ill gunshot people at a whack into a Chevy Silverado. And if you listen to the stories around the victims that he rescued, they are not, they're literally impossible to be true, but that's a different part of it. But so he allegedly does this, shoves 15 critically wounded gunshot victims in the truck. And then, this is on Fox News, not only did he deliver them to the hospital and, you know, do that, he then decided, you can read this on his Facebook page, you can read this in all the articles, that he went back with his bloody pickup truck and drove back and then allegedly got 15 more victims and brought them back and then went back for a third trip. That story is a lie. The first version of the story of him leaving with 15 victims is utterly hard to fathom. But how in the world would somebody drive in with a pickup truck covered in blood? How would he ever get back on the scene? How would the police and the ambulances ever allow him to pick up critically wounded people? And if they had not gotten care by that time, they'd be dead. But this is the story.
There's rescue also, it's strange because, like, usually in incidents like this, or even something like a political demonstration, I mean, there are people who have some sort of insignia on them to indicate that they're medics or they're rescue people or something. But this guy, I don't know, just somehow, maybe it's his charisma, I don't know, he has somehow is able to get away with transporting all these people this way. And another kind of funny story, and I don't want to dwell too much, but the one of Christina Kitkat, which is quite an interesting story. I mean, somebody who was shot and rescued, and but you know, they didn't take the boyfriend didn't take her to the ambulance. He took straight to his car and then to the hospital.
Christina Kitkat is somebody people really want to look at. Christina Kitkat was allegedly shot in the heart, and hit her left ventricle. According to the reports coming out, and you can verify, this is all over the mainstream media, she had four holes in her heart, holes in her lungs. Her boyfriend rescues her in a beer cart and then brings her to Taylor Winston's pickup truck, bypassing the ambulances allegedly on the scene. And that report is like, people say there's no ambulances on the scene, but this report says there's ambulances on the machine. But anyways, so they want us to believe a woman that is directly hit in the heart and the lungs by automatic gunfire. Not only, since she's rescued in a pickup truck, she remains conscious the entire ride to the hospital. And then when they get to the hospital, they put her in a wheelchair, and it's not nurses or doctors who provide care, but her rescuers who apply a EKG and an oxygen mask. But I don't know how you're going to get any oxygen on a respiration system that is filled with blood and lungs have collapsed and most likely in cardiac arrest. And then they wheel her away. It's all Hollywood drama. It's very poorly done. The stories make no logical sense. And all of the victims that are the survivors, the alleged survivors, every last one of them was either rescued in a pickup truck or even an Uber.
Yeah. Yeah, Debbie, could you talk a little bit about some of the investigation you've done into who these people were? You know, when you started investigating, the alleged victims and looking into their backgrounds. Are there anything that really stood out? Any patterns that seemed to keep presenting themselves when you dug deeper into their, whether it's their Facebook profiles or anything that was available through the major media?
Well, let me just finish my thought on this, and then it'll transition nicely into what you just asked. Now, remember, why are you seeing all of these victims being rescued, not getting trauma care, but being brought in pickup trucks in multiple loads, 15 in a whack, and Ubers? Well, real EMTs would notice if these people didn't have bullet wounds. Also should be noted that, according to the reporter on CNN, no hospitals allowed anybody in that night. They said that even family members were being turned away, because the big question for everybody is always, there's too many people who would know. That's what people say. How do they fake it? How do they fake it? So things that people need to keep in mind, and then I'll get into talking about what you're saying. Witness testimony from that night was, all the exits were closed and everybody was corralled out of one exit. You'll see that in multiple interviews of people who are doing the investigation, the alternative media. So everybody would have been removed from the scene immediately. They heard the gunshots. They heard the simulated fire. They heard everybody running. So most people were out of there. If you watch the footage, they left very quickly. So, that's taken care of. You don't have real rescue workers. You don't have anybody, any hospitals, anybody being witnesses at the hospitals. And then who would they fake it? How would they fake the victims? And when I started looking into the profiles, Christina Kit Kat was the one that really tipped me off. So I started to look at the people surrounding her. And so I looked at her GoFundMe manager's profile, a woman named Casey Napitolano. And this is all public. You can all go look at this on her profile. And I looked, and then I went to her page, which is over on Facebook, and I looked at her friends list, which was basically a who's who of low-level Hollywood actors and actresses, production companies, and makeup artists. And then I also started to look at histories of the victims, and there are people doing it. There's people over on LiveLeak who is doing a great series. If you search LiveLeak and you put in search for evidence Vegas shooting, this individual, you can go watch these videos for yourself, because this will give you a real idea of the issue around the victims. Is you look into the victims' profiles and you see that they don't live where they say that they live. They're at a different city at a different address. Lot of aliases. You see a lot of aliases for these people's names. If you look up their work addresses, it'll tell you that they work somewhere. They do not work. There's no record of employment, or they supposedly have a law office or some kind of a office set up, and there's no office. If you look at the building register, there's not tenants in that building. And and I really would recommend going to watch that over on LiveLeak, because this person actually shows you this. They go and they show you the aliases. They show you the different addresses and all of that. And this is consistent. You don't just see this for one or two people where you might get some weirdness. It's across the board with no matter who you search.
There's an interesting point that you raise about one of the differences between this incident and 9/11 was that with 9/11 you had the families being in your own words a pain in the ass, the 9/11 Jersey girls and the different families, because they were making a lot of noise and in this instance. Who are the victims' families coming forward making demands about, things not adding up, and instead we have somebody, this Jesus Campos guy showing up on Ellen. So I'm just wondering, like, what if you could,
Well, people, that's what that's a very legitimate question that a lot of people ask me. Okay, Debbie, you know, the things you're saying are making a lot of sense. My viewers have, you know, like, I looked at your evidence. Okay, you're making sense. You're making sense. But the thing that everybody asks is, what, you know, these people are criminals. They don't obviously don't have a problem with killing people. Why would they go to this trouble? And I really do think it's exactly what you just said, Michael. The victims' families are a royal pain in the ass. If you actually have 600 people shot, their lives destroyed, their lives ruined, or people murdered, you have families who are going to want answers. It is the relatives, it is the families of 9/11 that are the reason that we even got the sham of an investigation into 9/11 at all. We wouldn't have had an investigation. They got Henry Kissinger kicked off. They appointed another sham investigator, but they were the thorns in their side, and they're still their thorns in the side. 16 years later, they are still running websites and touring to get the truth out about 9/11. So, you know, yes, it's going to be a pain in the ass and it's going to be difficult up front, but you don't have 17 years of families, you know, making it their life's work to expose how the government actually works. So that is my hunch about why they go in this direction. And I think there's going to be false flags where you're going to see actual real murders and false flags where they're not. I still refuse to say that absolutely nobody was harmed or injured in this incident, but I am not seeing any real evidence of any gunfire, any real evidence that this occurred. It looks like a simulated event. I just don't even know, once you review the evidence and actually look at the stories they're trying to tell, how you can continue to believe that this is real. In fact, I think the only thing, the only thing that's holding this together is a public that is not actually reviewing what is publicly available to look at, and the cognitive dissonance and the fear about what is real and what is actually happening, and the fear of moving forward and admitting that this is what is actually happening with in our country right now.
I think we're just about at the end of our allotted time, but I want to use this as an opportunity to kind of plug the video that YouTube won't allow you to disappeared from YouTube, but you have it on a site. It's called BitChute, BitChute.com. And you got a 2-hour expose there. And I do encourage our listeners and readers to go and check it out, where you lay all of this information out there, as well as a very interesting conversation about cui bono. And I think that's – and there's also like all of your videos, it's you document all and chronicle all the links, so you back up everything that you have to say. Debbie, unless you have some parting words, I think we have to leave it there. But I
want to
thank
you. This is fine, Michael. Thank you for having me on.
So we've been speaking with Debbie Lou Signan. She is the Sane Progressive. You could check out her YouTube channel. And as I mentioned, check out her expose at bitchute.com. And I guess you could just plug Sane Progressive in the search engine and you should find it.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
Sean Helton is a writer, researcher, and associate editor with 21st Century Wire. He's probed the details of the Las Vegas mass shooting, along with other mass shootings in recent U.S. history. He recently composed a synthesis of his findings in an October 12th article entitled "The Las Vegas Mass Shooting: More to the Story Than We've Been Told." He joins us now from Phoenix, Arizona. Great to have you on the show, Sean.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me. Great opportunity. Appreciate it.
Okay, now,
As probably most of our listeners know, there are a number of anomalies in the official explanation, and I'm just wanted to get from you your take on any particular anomalies and discrepancies that you personally have chosen to focus on.
Yeah, there's in the article you mentioned, there's a whole framework of elements that questionable information surrounding the details of that particular mass shooting, whether it be the outfitting of cameras in the hotel room by the alleged gunman, Stephen Paddock, or exactly how he managed to even get this material, gear up towards his hotel room, or from the vantage point, how did he in terms of the reportage of many citizens as well as those online, many have suggested there might have been multiple shooters in this event. So there's a number of questions surrounding it. So the article goes into a lot of those different angles and, did my best to comprise in a compacted period of time, even though there was a tremendous amount of information about this case.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, you mentioned like the issue of the lone gunman scenario. And in this case, we have this elderly individual, Stephen Paddock. And, for a variety of reasons, it seems unlikely that he would have been acting alone. But could you give us some background on Mr. Paddock himself? I mean, because there's some interesting details about this individual, this guy who's apparently one of these high-stakes gamblers and, somebody who's apparently not had much military experience or basically suddenly overnight becoming this major superstar, much more proficient than people who've been trained for years. So what do we know about Mr. Paddock?
Well, we're told that, according to reports that he was a avid, well, he liked to hunt, that he basically, in addition to that, he's a hunting enthusiast, a licensed pilot. He had an affinity for luxury cruise vacations, not at all the typical gunman profile that we are used to seeing, those who are analyzing this type of information on a regular basis. So this case presents some very peculiar anomalies associated with that. Now, Paddock himself doesn't appear to have any military training for weaponry per se that we know of that's been released or acknowledged in any way. He does have a history of working for different government agencies in the 70s, working as an IRS agent from 78 to 84, the U.S. Postal Service in the 70s, and then later on in the late 80s, working for the predecessor company of Lockheed Martin during the 80s, which the company did acknowledge, but they wouldn't specify on which specific company, whether it was Lockheed Corporation or Martin Marietta in 1995. So they merged in 1995. So they wouldn't specify which company he worked for in the 80s, and very limited information regarding that particular element of the case.
Of course, there's the unusual couple of unusual interviews with his brother, indicating that he was that he couldn't possibly have or that he could have done it, but that it wasn't quite his nature. I mean, it was really quite a bizarre interview. It just seems like an unusual for a family member to be saying these things. I mean, if they really believe that, it's not something that he would have done, but he could have done it, and they don't even seem to be calling for his, for a fair trial. So do you have any thoughts about what, some of the narrative coming from the people that supposedly know him so well?
Yeah, there seems to be a contradictory sort of element concerning his past. And, you've heard reports of family members saying that He was a generous, kind man, and even his brother, Eric Paddock, even said that at some point during the first interview, I think, and even reiterated aspects of that in the second, but was always careful to inject the possibility that his brother may have been unhinged at the same time. So it seems like we have multiple narratives sort of overlapping each other in this particular aspect of the story, with the brother simultaneously trying to not necessarily, well, seemingly not incriminating his brother while also seeming simultaneously incriminating him. So there seemed to be an overlap in terms of that. Those interviews seem to be very baffling to those of us who analyze this stuff in terms of, in terms of that part of the case, it seemed extremely theatrical to me. Now, I'm not really sure of Eric Paddock's background per se, but the sheer theatricality and spectacle of those interviews seemed to basically shoot an overview over the entire thing in terms of his reaction, his emotional outbursts during the interviews. While of course, in any tragedy, you're going to have these maybe conflicting emotions about things, and possibly maybe not the best idea to meet with media during a time of tragedy. If in fact you believe that your brother was a part of this, I'm shocked that he was so forthcoming with reporters about coming forward in this way. Because if anything, it actually just seemed to add another bizarre, surreal element to the story instead of really explain anything.
Mm. Can you comment on the way you see information about the shooting being controlled, contained, distorted, and otherwise garrisoned? And if that's, if there's anything new about the way it's being, addressed with all the spotlight that's been on that event over the last, I guess it's a couple of weeks now.
Are you referring to the theories regarding multiple shooters and acoustic evidence?
Let's just start with, for example, there have been timelines have been altered, like just over the course of the first handful of days. Can you comment on the significance of those changes?
Yeah. So the odd thing is with the timeline, and of course, Sheriff Joseph Lombardo suggested that it was not such a big deal that the timelines have changed. The reality is that, barring any hyper speculation, it does significantly change the crime scene. We were told initially that Jesus Campos, the Mandalay Bay security guard who supposedly started working for them in June, was the hero star witness of this event. And Stephen Shook was also a second eyewitness to the shooter, alleged gunman Paddock. So in this frame, we were told that the shooting, before the concert mass shooting took place, we were told that Campos had gone up to the hotel, checked on a door alarm of some sort, and then had noticed the suite or had been walking up the hallway and noticed something about the area, a door alarm nearby, and then Paddock opened fire on him, supposedly shooting 200 rounds out towards him inside the hallway of the Mandalay Bay on the 32nd floor. Now, this would have caused a tremendous amount of damage. Not only would have been damaged, but it would have been extremely loud, likely resulting in many 911 calls from anybody who had been in the vicinity of this particular shooting. And so far, we've seen a very scant, if anything, really coming from the 32nd floor. There, so far, from what I can surmise, there hasn't been a single 32nd floor eyewitness other than the two security guards who've come forward publicly to state anything about this event, which is a very shocking, strange thing when you're considering this is the most deadly U.S. Mass shooting in modern U.S. history. So when we're thinking of these things, that part of it is a huge element when you're looking at the timeline. So they presented this detail that Campos was the one who was that sort of stopped or maybe slowed down the tragedy itself.
And then they reversed the details a couple days later to suggest that he was shot earlier, and then the concert mass shooting had begun at 10:05. He was shot potentially at 9:59. They claimed this was an error, a manual error that was written in. It was not to be discussed in this way. Lombardo came forward basically suggesting that that was an error and that the mainstream media and alternative media alike had gotten that part of the story wrong, and that basically sort of shifted blame back on those who are analyzing the case and maybe scrutinizing close details of this case, when in reality it was really the officials themselves, the FBI and the Las Vegas police, who struggled to create a timeline that made any sense. And then so they basically they reversed it and went back to the original story. But what's odd now, and I know Jesus Campos finally resurfaced recently after disappearing for a week or more, on the Ellen show. I haven't yet watched that interview, but I'm guessing that they're going to try to perpetuate a hero narrative again now. But the interesting thing here is they had shied away, and even Lombardo himself kind of shied away from mentioning him as a hero in this event once they changed the timeline details several times, because they basically went back to the original story, which was just strange and really kind of unprecedented in a case of this magnitude.
Now, there have been skeptical accounts that have been registered about whether the massacre even happened or whether it happened to the extent that it did. I mean, there's been references to crisis actors and they all using the same talking points about blood everywhere and it was like a war zone. And of course, you're talking about shots from a quarter mile away, and the idea that that there was this blood fest, and then these eyewitnesses keep talking about it. But I guess I'm just wondering, like, because I know you've been quite diligent about the being careful about the points that you would want to raise in a public discussion about this. Is there any doubt? Is there any serious question in your mind about the type and the number of casualties that have come forward? I mean, could the scale of the crisis be far smaller than the official account?
It's difficult to say. I mean, I think at this point, there are a lot of multiple angles to look at that. It's hard to sort of commit to one side or the other. I feel that this particular mass shooting displays hallmarks of a very sophisticated dynamic that suggests both real aspects, very real aspects of people being injured and killed, and also potentially fake or even crisis actor-like scenarios. I think it was a mixture of things that were going on in this particular event, and it was a highly orchestrated, highly choreographed event that really, I feel undoubtedly that it couldn't have been just one person who would have been responsible for this event. The level of coordination of the different eyewitness accounts, many of them dovetailing what you're suggesting. I have seen some of the footage of some of these people being interviewed and put in front of cameras on media who have accounts basically discussing almost exact details, but in a very cold, sort of sterile, even disconnected way. I have seen some of that footage, but I've also heard real stories, which seem to me to be very real. And, in this particular event, I'm aware of at least a few people who were even at that event. So personally, so I know that there are real and maybe manufactured elements to this case. So that's, in terms of the numbers, I don't know. I wouldn't be able to speculate on what was real, what wasn't real. I think we're just starting to sift through a lot of that stuff, but we may never know. We may never know the exact number of injured. We may never know the exact number of killed. Many of these particular events, and I've covered a lot of these over the years, seem to the event seems so complex in terms of breaking down the various background elements of details, the characters involved, that whether or not victims are real sometimes becomes a a rabbit hole in a sense that people go down that is, I don't want to say is not fruitful in terms of figuring out the crime itself, but becomes a bit more of an obsession than maybe detailing elements of the crime that could expose larger, maybe black operation elements of the crime or potentially false flag elements of a crime, where you can show historical references. And I try to use and contextualize that kind of element in my reports always with these types of shootings, because it's important for people to always go back to that historical reference points, those different various reference points, to see that these things have occurred throughout history, and that those things are worth looking at to solve, potentially solve a crime.
I'm wondering if you could put the October 1st tragedy in the context of other mass shootings that you've studied and that have taken place in the last decade or so. Is there a pattern that has emerged about who the perpetrators are and how and why these events unravel the way they do?
Well, as far as I can tell in terms of what I've done research-wise, there seems to be varying crisis management teams involved in either prior to many of these shootings occurring, many of these high-profile shootings. And even in Las Vegas, the case of Las Vegas, there seems to be, I believe it's called the Readiness Group, the former FBI agent who started it, and I'm not remembering his name at the moment, but basically I look for clues in media reports early on, and I didn't write about this in that first report or any subsequent reports since then, but it's definitely something I'll consider going back to if I really do an even bigger analysis of this particular event. That particular group had to comment, that crisis management group commented shortly after the shooting, and I know that they work very closely with MGM Resorts. So I thought that was interesting, and I've noticed a pattern with some of these events in the past. Some of the people who often are a part of these crisis management teams seem to chime in shortly after a disaster has taken place. If you go back and look at some of those cases, and I have it, some of it documented at Global Research and other places, and of course at 21st Century Wire. But, you know, it's one of those things that I've definitely noticed that there are sometimes elements that security-wise that are developing in this country, that's the pattern I see, is the overt push for securitization of this country, whether it be police state or surveillance equipment, body scanners, that type of thing. This usually ushers in that kind of stuff. But of course, the usual calls for gun control and things of that nature to sort of get people emotionally divided on that issue over a tragedy. But I do find it very odd that these particular crisis management companies seem to chime in right near or after an event very often when you're looking at reports. And it's stuff that most people might miss if they're not really looking for that.
I find that there's a tendency, at least among some independent media, to jump to the conclusion that, it's a false flag. They're trying to bring in gun control. And they start looking at the incidents like this through that lens. Is there any danger associated with that kind of approach to trying to dissect an incident such as this one?
Yeah. So, you know, while those could be potential issues to be concerned with, social, political issues that are, you know, the politicization of these mass shootings is definitely a very real thing. Now, how it's sort of being sort of pushed out there by certain media outlets. You know, some outlets will overzealously report elements of that, of those types of the crime, or that part of the crime that they think is occurring, or that narrative is occurring. But for me, you know, I look at that stuff as sort of background noise to the actual forensics of the crime. So, of course, those things maybe are concerning in the overall picture of the public. But there's always going to be a debate about that stuff. And then when you look at the gun sales after these events, they soar. Usually the stocks go up like crazy. There's a pattern that we've seen in many of these shootings. I think you could make the argument that sometimes these events really are actually very good for the gun industry. So I'm not suggesting that, meaning I support that. Of course, I don't support any of this. And any of this mass tragedy is a terrible thing for people to have to go through. Whether real or manufactured psychological trauma, it's a terrible thing to have to endure. You know, it's just that I believe that there are financial and political interests that benefit from a divided public on socio-political issues concerning gun reform or security.
Could you maybe elaborate a little bit on the prime beneficiaries of this particular shooting?
Of this particular shooting?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know if I could speak to who are the beneficiaries of this particular event. I think you do need to look at why CEO Jim Murren was sort of thrown into the public eye over the the claim over the MGM stocks being sold off before the shooting. Now, that may very well have happened because Kip Herridge from the Wall Street firm that analyzes Wall Street data, I mean, he's a very credible source in Wall Street anyway, so it would seem unlikely that he would even comment about it if it wasn't something that actually occurred. I know that initially that claim came out of 4chan, and I think it's important to be skeptical of some of the information we see there and really scrutinize some of that information so we can get a better picture. But when we look at the MGM stock situation, it seemed to put Jim of Mandalay Bay into the frame, and we have to wonder why that is. Are there other people who would benefit from him taking the fall for this particular event in some kind of way, making him sort of the quote-unquote false flag fall guy for the Mandalay Bay shooting? I'm not suggesting that's what he is. I'm saying that meme, that alternative narrative has been put out there. But we should always treat any of these lines of narratives and storylines with skepticism and question all of these events in minute ways, too. And all these details should be questioned. Why would he be put in that frame? Why would he put himself in that light? Given the circumstances of the nature of this crime, if he was involved, I'm not suggesting he is, if he was, why would he then publicly have traded a bunch of stocks beforehand to make a bunch of money when it makes it look like he took a financial benefit of this particular scenario? So to me, it seems like that could be more or less a red herring, and that that's something that we should look closer at. It's important to note those details that the stocks maybe were sold, but what was the reason why this particular company has been put in the frame in terms of, you know, taking the full responsibility of this event? Now, I know there's been a lot of speculation, and there's a lot of Twitter noise, I'll say, out there in social media about elements of Mandalay Bay and the level of security, but we should also be dubious right now in this country, in America. There's a lot of far left people who benefit politically, and there's a lot of far right people now who are benefiting politically from these kinds of events. And then these channels come up and different websites pop up who seem to have all the answers about these crimes and who might be perpetrating them, and whether it's so-and-so takes responsibility. And we should be very dubious of these claims and websites that kind of push these strong, heavily circumstantial narratives, if there's any evidence at all. So to me, it seems very odd that they would be pushing these angles that that haven't been proven in any way. And it's a quick way to shorten your career as a journalist, in my opinion, if you're going to take really strong narratives of a subject and not scrutinize the minutiae and the behind the scenes to really get closer to maybe a better overview of what actually took place.
Finally, Sean, I was wondering if you could speak to your appraisal of the way media, both mainstream and alternative or independent, have been reporting or not on this event. Well, what stands out for you?
Well, you know, it's a strange case. This was unlike many other shootings. So this is a very hard piece case to compare to a lot of other shootings. Although there are some things that we're seeing now kind of popping into frame. It's not, there's a lot of stuff out there, I believe, that is designed to confuse the public. And I don't want to criticize any one outlet, but I think that we have to look at things like certain outlets, whether it be mainstream media or alternative media, pushing terror narratives without any validity or any proof. When you look at who put that particular meme out there, the person who usually puts those memes out is site intelligence, and they're very entrenched with the CIA and very often have their own narrative to push politically.
They're the ones that come out with the bin Laden videos, right?
Yes. All the heavily doctored Al Qaeda videos that we've seen over the years. That even the whole Bell Pottinger situation, where the Pentagon paid for $500 million worth of fake terror videos. They've been involved in that spectrum of dissemination of information when it comes to propaganda. So we should always be dubious of where these claims come from. And when media outlets then take that first run of where that first narrative went, and then go whole hog behind that particular idea, I think it's a dangerous place to put yourself in from an analyst point of view, because you're not able to really see it with open eyes. You're not able to really clearly dig inside the crime, because you've already basically put a particular narrative on it. It painted it with a particular narrative that you can no longer get out of that particular framework of thinking, and it becomes more about, say, the story of terror or illegal aliens, because now there's a question about whether Campos is really Campos and his social security number. And I'm not suggesting I believe in these reports wholeheartedly. I think it's important to look at that information and see it for what it is, but also look at the political interest putting that information out, the media outlets that are pushing that particular element of the story. Are they serving their own interests, or are they trying to solve a crime? I think that's the question that people should ask.
Well, Sean Helton, we really appreciate your thoughts on this topic. I want to thank you for coming on and sharing your views with our listeners.
Well, thank you so much, Michael. It's great to be here, and hopefully we can do this again sometime.
For sure. We've been speaking to Sean Helton. He's a writer, researcher, and associate editor with 21st Century Wire. He recently authored the article, The Las Vegas Mass Shooting, More to the Story Than We've Been Told, which is now posted on the Global Research website. You can read more of his archived work at the site 21stcenturywire.com.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.